Norm sent him a letter and said, I want to be on this committee. I knew they weren't going to do that.
Exactly.
I just said.
Are we recording? Everybody's happy? All right. Call the meeting to order, Sagebrush Ecosystem Council, Thursday, June 23rd. Slated for 8:30 a.m. We're almost on time. Public comment. Public comment here in the room. Public comment? All right, seeing none.
JJ, can we get a roll call?
No. Kelly, would you like to do a roll call?
Chairman, go get the,
Here in spirit.
Chris McKenzie.
Here.
Alan, not here. Alan Biagi. Steve Boyce.
Here.
Evan Lister.
Yep.
Sherm Swanson.
Yes.
Jerry M. Sarla Lacy.
Here.
Willie Malini.
Here.
Bill Dunkelberger. Mark Jackson. John Raby.
I'm here.
Or Allen.
I'm sure you got a space over there somewhere, Mark. The table.
Ray Dotson. Jennifer Ott.
I'm going to sit in for her today.
Don't we have Dominique for Brad? Tony Wansley. Okay, we have a quorum.
I'll sit in for Wansley.
Old habits are hard to break, huh?
Time's getting pretty tough in the department. It's kind of like that pond that turns over every once in a while.
You want that
got some fresh water back on top. All right. So we got a couple guys have a hard stop. A couple folks do. So we're going to try to move through this fairly quickly. And our goal is to be out of here before noon so we don't get in trouble for not having a lunch break. So approval of the agenda. Is there a motion to approve the agenda for today? No changes.
Exactly.
All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Any opposed? Approval of minutes. You guys have a copy of them in front of you. You also had received them electronically. Any additions, corrections to the minutes? If not, entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Any opposed? Council member items of correspondence. We'll start around. Chris, anything?
No, sir.
Willie?
No.
Bevan?
No.
Steve? Sherm?
Quick one for me. As many of you already know, I have retired from MD Energy. So with me today is Matt Johns. He's the new Vice President of Environmental and Lands.
Good morning.
So I know many of you have been on the field trip yesterday. So just really enjoyed very, very much being on the council.
We're going to miss you, and we definitely appreciated your input. So, Kelly, correspondence?
Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly McGowan for the record. I have a letter. I have a letter from Sherm, if you can help me with the name of the organization.
The Coalition for Healthy Nevada Lands, Wildlife, and Free Roaming Horses.
So they sent a letter to Chairman Merkley and Ranking Member Murkowski. Primarily addressing the wild horse and burro overpopulation issues. So I will send that. I got it yesterday, so I will send that to everyone once I get back into the office. But wanted to make you aware of that. And yeah, that's it.
Okay. Excuse me. Presentation on McGinnis Tuscora Geothermal Study, Topographic Impedance Layer, Population Modeling, Conservation Planning Tools, Updated Habitat Maps, Action, and Sage Grouse Response. Council may recommend continued agency support or inclusion of the new science into the CCS or the conservation plan. Dr. Coats, the floor is yours, sir.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pleased to be here today. Good to see a lot of you. I haven't seen you in a while. Should I sit or stand, or does it matter? I've got a lot for you today. I haven't presented for you in quite some time. We've completed a lot of research, a lot of contractual obligations. But I'm bringing in some other science that we've also done that can help potentially inform the conservation credit system, other types of management plans. And so that's a long title, as you can tell. I did break it into three talks. The talks are a little lengthy. I can move through them quickly. We could skip over some slides. I know there's a short stop at noon. And I figured it was scheduled for two, and this is most of the agenda, but there's other items. So I'm going to move rather quickly and skip over some of this as we go, just to accommodate. But what I'd first like to present is a study that we've been conducting for about 10 years on the geothermal plants that went in 2012 on Guinness Hills in Tuscarora. I'm going to talk about the findings here, a topographic impedance layer that we developed that can be useful as a conservation tool, and some modeling that you could do with that, projecting impacts to other areas when it comes to development of pipes. And I'm going to move in on a second presentation and talk about some conservation efforts effectiveness that we've pilot studied in the bi-state area. You heard me talk last time in 2021. I can't remember the month I came here and talked about population trends range-wide and discussed how the Great Basin was quite different than other areas of the range. But the bi-state was doing something a little different than the Great Basin. And I'm going to speak to that, why that might be, and how we're expanding this conservation effectiveness analysis range-wide, but what it might do to help inform some of the decisions you're making here and some of the responses sage-grouse on different actions on the landscape. The last presentation is really a presentation on updating the maps that we've been in development. We've had several different renditions of them. Now we're really making some strides here to get some really good information in there. The remote sensing is much more advanced now. The mapping products coming out of that are far greater than they were when we started this endeavor back in 2014-13. It's been nearly 10 years, and I want to talk about some of the products there. And how combining some of these mapping products, selection and survival, can really help inform source sink dynamics, some important concepts I'll bring in and discuss here in this talk. So just getting started with the geothermal talk, and if you want to have discussion as we go or after each of the presentations, maybe that's best. I don't know how Kelly, if you have a recommendation on how to run this, but I'm just going to kind of move through these slides. So as of right now, there has been some information, as you all know, on impacts of both renewable and non-renewable energy on sage-grouse populations, but currently there hasn't been anything on geothermal. Now, the way that we actually studied this was quite different than other types of studies. I'm going to show kind of the power of this analysis. We had a longitudinal data set, 10 years of data, marked the grouse out there, and we were able to really get at some different types of questions. For example, we could look at the pattern of this effect. This is something that's done, but not necessarily in a before-after controlled impact type of study design. This is the most powerful type of design. It's a gold standard, where you can look at the effect before and after and then compare that to the control to account for those temporal changes that might otherwise confound the effect that you're finding. So we looked at that first, but it just with an independent data set of LEC counts. And then we dove in and looked at the process. What's actually causing, essentially, or responsible for that pattern that we're observing in that first objective. For that process, we really need to dive in, put transmitters on birds, model population growth rate as a function of survival, reproduction, those types of things. and figure out exactly what's causing the issue. We can then take both those sources of information and develop conservation planning tools. And these are inference models, essentially, models for inferential the type of support, and go to other areas and make predictions as to what we might find in those other areas. So, as you all are well aware, these are the two sites in Nevada. I'll just skip over that and get right to the pattern. We looked at two different responses on this. We're looking at population growth rate, and we're also looking at LEC absence. The population growth rate over here on one side, basically what we're interested in is if there's some kind of distance effect where we're going to notice a change in population size. For example, is there in the red area, that kind of bullseye there, are we seeing a change in grouse numbers in those areas? Whereas on the opposite side, we're looking for extirpation, whether or not these leks have reached extirpation and what that might mean for these other virtual populations, if that is actually a source for those populations. So getting right to the population growth rate, we came up with a process to understand what that distance effect is and how that distance effect changes through time, looking across these different scales, 0, 2, 5, 10, 15, 20, and 30 kilometers out, looking for the greatest amount of evidence of the difference between within that scale, 2 kilometers, and beyond that scale, so within 5 kilometers and beyond 4. So we're kind of looking for basically where that effect takes place. Now, before we kind of dive into the results, there's some pretty important concepts to understand here on population growth rate. We use this symbol lambda to represent that, but it's a very simple actual calculation on the surface. It's just the number of birds in time t, for example, if it's 2022, divided by the number of birds in time t minus 1, which is 2021. So a ratio of 1 would mean no change. Above 1 is increasing, below 1 is decreasing. Pretty simple. So lambda of 0.9 means that there is a, in this case, a 10% annual decrease. That's a typo, apologize for that. 10% annual decrease. Now, a 10% annual decrease actually relates over a 10-year period, cumulative, to an 89% decrease, because it's every year you're getting that reduction of 10%. That's important to point out. The other one that's important to point out is that lek size is important when we're thinking about top lambda. For example, these two populations have the same lambda, that 10% decrease. But it's going to mean something different for these populations with all these birds as opposed to these populations with fewer birds. And just to do the math there, a single year loss is 21 birds in this population, a single year loss is 6, and 136 over that 10-year period as opposed to 37 in that population. These are important concepts to understand because we need to really identify which leks are going to potentially experience the greatest impact based on lek size, based on population growth rate. Now, that's the kind of the simple part of this. We get into a lot more sophistication in estimating this, but one thing to recognize too is we could convert that lambda into an intrinsic growth rate by just taking the log. And this just rescales it. So anything below zero is decreasing, above zero is increasing. The reason why I want to put this up there so you can interpret it is it's basically just rescaling. So we use a state-based model to actually calculate what that intrinsic growth rate is rather than actually do just a fraction. And the reasoning is because lek counts are imperfect, we got to incorporate all that uncertainty in the imperfection of those lek counts. So we incorporate that observation error, and then we can make an estimate as to what that apparent abundance is, and then what that intrinsic growth rate is in that model environment. So what we're doing is we're modeling that growth rate before, which is the 2006 to 2012, and after, which is 2012 to 2018. And given those, because this is a Bayesian environment, we get a lot of possibilities of what that growth rate is, if you will, that kind of make this distribution that is somewhat bell curve shaped. But nevertheless, it has statistical values with it. It has medians, it has standard deviations, and so forth. But it does have all that uncertainty. We can take those distributions and create ratios out of them to get to the amount of evidence using this before
impact control design. For example, we take the ratio of impact control before, impact control after, and then we take a ratio of those ratios. Again, we're taking ratios of the distributions. What's important to know is how to read these figures. If our Bakke ratios are in this region below that dashed line, that means that there's strong evidence of imbalance. In this case, the median value is 0.5, so we could conclude that there's about a 50% decrease. Now, the posterior distribution, which is all the uncertainty in that estimation process and our observation error, is captured in this bell curve. And you can see that 100% of those realizations are on the left side of that bell curve, meaning we're highly confident in this effect. This isn't the actual effect. This is just a visualization of what the results, how to interpret the results. Bakke ratio of 1, that means no evidence. If it's on the other side, then we have an increase, 50% increase. Okay, let's get to the results here. So what we found was that the strongest evidence came out at 5 kilometers for a short-term effect. I'm going to discuss the long-term effect a bit later. But what we see here, here's the actual data. You can see it looks very similar to the cartoon that I showed previously, except the median value of that distribution is approximately a 24% decrease, which is about a 0.76. But what's important to point out is these are the different estimates for before control, before impact, after control, and after impact. And you can see that the before impact, which is the treatment site before it actually went in, was at 1.15 as the average lambda value. It's been converted back to lambda, meaning there was 15% growth in this population. After the impact, you see a 0.9. That means that there's a 10% reduction, as I showed previously. Whereas there was no change before control and after control, which is why that all of those distributions, or the entire distribution, is on the left side of that line. So very strong evidence that the impact actually happened within 5 kilometers. Let me just show you the data.
You mentioned a 10% reduction. Wouldn't that be a 25% reduction, 1.15 to 0.9?
That's right. Correct. 25% reduction from the original lambda, 10% decrease annually.
Yep.
It went from a 15% increase to a 10% decrease. Okay, so if we look at the actual estimates of these, and here we're back on the intrinsic growth. So that R, everything above zero, population is increasing, below zero, it's decreasing. This is not abundance. If we were tracking abundance, these lines would be going up. We're tracking growth. So every year it's above that dashed line, that population is growing, above that ratio. I look at the red, which is the geothermal plant, versus the blue, which is outside of the geothermal plant area. We have increases in every single year until the plant went into 2012 and it's experiencing decrease. Whereas what we see in the blue is very reminiscent of what we see basically in sage grouse populations elsewhere, this cycling occurs that really largely correlates with drought conditions. What this indicates to us is that plant area was probably a source population because it was growing even during the low years, which is like 2005, 6, 7, that population maintained growth. The reason is because those plants are put in areas where you have a network of geothermal activity, of wet meadow networks and so forth that the grouse rely on. So these probably have very high recruitment rates, which we show in our data. I'll get to that process. And grouse are spilling over into these peripheral populations. And we can see a slight decline in those peripheral populations as you see there. And we got good populations. So there's our 1.15 increase. That's on average every year. And a 0.9 decrease on the average every year after. Okay, I'm going to talk about the Leck absence model. This is basically a binomial distribution. Basically, when the Leck hits effectively two males, it's considered absent in our case, which is what the definition is for inactivity with the NDAL database. And we found that the scale with the most evidence was 2 kilometers here. And here's our similar distribution. Nearly all those year distributions were greater than one, supporting increase of Leck absence. It's flipped now, and that's because this is an increase in absence rate rather than a decrease in lambda. So it's on the right side of that. But let's look at the after impact. We're
a 50%. That means that within 2 kilometers, there's a 50% chance that that LEC will be inactive. And there's outside of that, after patrol, there's about a 2% chance on patrols. So pretty strong evidence that a lot of these LECs went inactive, which makes sense because population growth rate, if it maintains it at a decreasing growth rate, is inevitably going to become inactive. And that's why we're also seeing the scale effect, a 5 kilometer growth rate effect, but a 2 kilometer inactivity effect. And what this basically means is as it propagates across the landscape and those and has impacts at closer distances, which I'm going to show on the process, it actually causes inactivity at those closer distances first, not often itself. Okay, if you remember last time I gave a talk here, I talked about a targeted annual warning system and how we developed this range walk. This basically takes the population estimation trend at one scale and compares it to a larger scale, see if there's any kind of decoupling that's taken place, which is what I just showed in that last figure. That decoupling from that larger cyclical trend. What we can do is we can pick up on where this decoupling happens and look at the effect of that, call it a watch. If it merits some type of monitoring and a warning if it's a real precipitous draw. So I'm gonna show you what happened at the geothermal site with this decoupling. Now these are the LECs that made it into the actual analysis. We have some pretty strict criteria because we need to be strong about our inference here. As to what LECs made it in. So very few LECs in this actual population made it into this analysis. This is an independent analysis we ran range-wide, published it in this report here. But by 2015, we had a watch on this LEC here, and then by 2016, that hit a warning. That means that LEC's about to go extinct. And then by 2017, a watch on this LEC here. So those are the two closest LECs to the plant, whereas these other ones did not hit any type of a signal like that. When we bring in all of the LECs, those that didn't make that analysis, but the ones that were included in our previous analysis, the squares represent unmodeled LECs for the TAWS, the targeted annual warning system, and circles represent the modeled ones. And as you can see, there's quite a few more LECs, but what's important to point out here is the color, the red, means those LECs went inactive, and the blue, those LECs still name. You can see 5 out of 6 of the LECs that were unmodeled went inactive. So those were fairly small LECs, a little bit disparate in the data set, but nevertheless, those LECs dropped out of the analysis for the TAWS and went inactive closest to the LEC. Okay, so these are the patterns we recognize from LEC count data, both active and inactive. An actual population growth rate from the state space model. Let me talk about the process here. To understand this, we need to understand demography of these birds. And we do know, as I pointed out, that NT or NT plus one is a function of lambda. But lambda is really made up of survival and recruitment. So we can model these different parameters too, survival and recruitment. All of the different things that make up recruitment, like nesting, brood rearing, juvenile survival, and so forth. We can model it in relation to all these different types of environmental factors. Now, of course, the one we're after is anything related to the geothermal plant, but we have to control for all the other factors out on the landscape, like conifer cover, sagebrush cover, ravens, and so forth, because they all affect survival and recruitment as well. So we bring all of this into a modeling environment, we track these grouse with telemetry, and we're able to develop these encounter histories and look at how they respond to these environments and estimate parameters for them. Now we develop this new layer which serves as a proxy for noise and sound. It's basically a topographic impedance layer, which is more of it's a resistance surface when something is propagating or radiating across the landscape. You can see how it kind of works its way up, high resistance in the blue, low resistance in the red. See how it works its way up into different valleys and so forth. This isn't really zoomed in very well, but it does a really good job in flat areas of being very low resistance and more topographic areas, high resistance. Without getting into detail on how this was calculated, we used this as a variable in the model to look at
the influence of this and just straight distance on survival. But first we need to understand what the effects of all these other variables are. And the problem is this is all of our demographic data was taken after the plant went in. So we needed to control for, if you will, a before by understanding what the effects are if the plant wasn't there. So what we did was we took data from all these other populations, numerous study sites out there. We have about 16 different other study sites and measured the impacts of all these different environmental variables. And once we could estimate those effects, and then we could develop a predictive model of what that looks like for this specific area, and that's this model here. The red is a higher hazard. This is an example for nesting, but we did this for every life stage. And the blue is lower hazard. The reason why those red areas exist, largely because it's higher elevation, conifer cover, less sagebrush cover, those types of things in those areas. You can see the plant, that's not considered a high hazard because we haven't modeled that aspect yet. This is all just the control variables. Once we develop that layer and use that as our baseline hazard function, now we can model the actual influences to view a climate plan. And that's what we see here. Now, this is kind of a tricky figure, but it needs to be because there is some complexity in ecology, and I'm going to try to explain it very simply. We had an interaction between ravens, topographic influence, and distance. That means that each of those variables were important, and they all depend on each other. So the effect of one variable is dependent on those other two variables. Now, we had a lot of data, so we could get at this interaction. If we take, and I broke it down so that it's easier to understand, under just low raven density scenarios, which is what this figure represents, and if we look at topographic impedance index, which is here at zero, that means we have a very low impedance index, we see a very strong distance effect. This means as you go out across a valley where there's no topography, distance has a very strong effect on that survival in this case. Now, what's interesting is when distance is very short, topographic impedance has a very strong effect. So that means that hills that are in the way, those types of things, they mediate that distance effect. And so even at close objects, it can still be protected, if you will, depending on the topography. So there's a lot of scenarios across that plane, combinations of distance and topographic impedance that we can look at under low raven density. But what's important is when we increase raven density above a threshold that we have identified in previous research at 0.4 ravens per square kilometer, which is too much for sage grouse to handle across the entire site, we level that entire plane. And you see that nest survival probabilities are around 18%, which is identical almost to what our model predicted from our raven study that we did when we isolated raven populations across the range. So what this basically means is if ravens are very abundant far from the plant, those nest survival probabilities are going to be very low. However, the next question would be, well, how does the plant affect raven populations? That's the indirect effects that we talk about that might be causing the plant to have effect. And so what we've done in previous research is looked at different variables in relation to raven density, raven probability of occurrence. This is an example. We have a density map that we created for the Great Basin. And these figures represent those different effects. And two of these figures are related to development, which shows strong effects. That's the peaks that you see there, and then this bottom one is transmission markers, which is also the strong effect. So what this basically means is when these developments come in, like geothermal, they offer subsidies for ravens in the way of perching, in the way of food, and so forth, and nesting substrates, where raven densities increase in those areas. Now, even at low raven densities, though, as I showed from that figure, there's still effects. And what we think is happening there is that the noise associated with the geothermal plant, the traffic, the lights, all these different activities cause these birds to behave differently. And at low raven densities, they could find the nest faster. And even adult survival was lower based on that. There's just a graphic showing the increases in rate and density through time at the area on the site. And here's the Tuscarora. You can see the increasing through time at that site. Now, we've created these distance or the density surface models. Lost that slide there, but we created these density surface models that are in real time so we could track rate and density changes across the entire state. Those are statewide. Another product. Don't have time to get into, but that's what these two sites look like.
Dr. Coates, do you have a real quick question? So you showed some pretty intensive rated increases in the area of those two geothermal plants, but is that pretty indicative across the whole state anyway?
It is.
Okay.
Yes, but largely because of anthropogenic subsidies across the state.
So what is it about a geothermal plant that would be attractive to a raven?
Quite a bit. I mean, it does come with food. Any kind of traffic is going to deliver some food, but it also has, we see ravens on the pipelines quite a bit out there, perching up there.
So
there's nesting substrate. However, I want to say Ormat has done a fantastic job at trying to remove any nests in those areas, prevent ravens from being out there. Those types of things, and it's why we're actually getting that variation in raven density, so we can look at how low raven numbers in relation to close distances and low impedance are influencing nest survival. So, yeah, you got to have, for that interaction, you have to have data across that entire continuum, and we were able to do that at the site largely because of those reasons. So the broader effects that I'm talking about aren't necessarily related to Tuscarora and Guinness specifically as far as raven density increases. But we do know from our research that's the main reason why they're increasing. Pretty much almost every covariate that comes out is related to anthropogenic subsidies for raven occurrence and density. Okay, I'm going to talk about how we could use this as decision support. Nice thing about these models, they, again, make us aware, allow us to estimate parameters, understand the relationships, but if we stop there, then there's very little utility on what to do about the situation. You can take the model and you can make inference if you're comfortable in other areas across other energy structures and so forth. If you're comfortable with the energy structure sharing a lot of similar attributes, as I'm talking about with ravens, then you can make inferences in those different sites. So what we've done is created, we have these maps we've created. You've seen these maps, Abundance and Space Use Index, which is basically a mapping product that pulls in information about how many birds are on the lek, getting back to that idea that not every lek is the same. We have these high-density areas, low-density areas. If we apply lambda to those high-density areas, it means a lot more than applying it to a low-density area. So we bring in the Space Use Abundance Index. It's essentially a density index. And then that also is based on that configuration, how close these leks are together. So it's a nice broad scale pool. And then we can predict population growth rate changes based on environmental covariates associated with any site across this entire region and the state of Nevada, and then look at the effects of geothermal factors. Give you an example of that. Here's a predicted baseline of lambda before geothermal activity. Lambda being one, remember, is no change. So you see a little bit of change in there decreasing. And we see this fitting our trend data across the state. This is pretty typical of most sites. You bring in any type of activity here, in this case, you can apply the model, and you can see kind of how it influences population growth rate within that specific area, propagating from that point. And you could draw in any structure you want, linear, whatever feature in its model will. That. You see how it kind of carries up these little valleys and so forth based on the topographic impedance index. But we also have to think about, and this isolates that effect. If we subtract those surfaces, this is strictly from the geothermal, not from other environmental covariates. And again, this is another site. This isn't the one we made inference to. This is another geothermal site. Or the one that I talked about before. Now, we have all these leks over there on the right side, the west side of the site, and no leks on the east. So obviously, these effects should actually be more prominent to the east side of that geothermal. So when we bring this layer in, apply that lambda value, this is the type of response we get, which serves as a great index. We can actually track this per LEC. I'm going to show that next. It demonstrates how the effect actually propagates across the landscape based on topography, all the environmental variables, and the configuration of the plant. So this is, these are just some examples of a low abundance, low impact, high abundance, low impact, and a high abundance, high impact, the differences that you would get in those outputs. And again, all of these, they represent pixel values, or quantifiable. Now we just pull the pixel values, and we can rank these and look at which one has the most effect. We could try to isolate where the effects are. We could change the configuration of the plant. There's a lot of possibilities here to do in order to minimize those effects, decisions about mitigation. If we look at all of the geothermal plants that have been proposed, that are either planned or leased, permitted at this point across the state, this is kind of the type of ranking that I talked about we can actually do. We break that. I'm not going to talk about all these columns, but basically we can look at 10-year lambda, 5-year lambda, 2-year, and so forth, and then the change in those and different ranking patterns. But it turns out that when we did do that for all of these different sites, Tuscarora and McGinnis actually fell in the 1 and 3 ranking of that entire list. So there were some pretty strong source populations of these grouse. Now, if we're interested, we've been in talks in the Senate Science Working Group on how to apply this on a LEC-by-LEC basis so we can understand impacts to individual LECs. So I'm going to show what we could actually do here. We know what these LEC sizes are. Even when we're not conducting LEC counts of these LECs, we're making inferences to what that abundance is based on our state space model. And that model takes a lot of things into consideration. All the counts have been conducted in that LEC in the past, the counts from nearby LECs, and allows you to influence what that abundance is. Of course, your uncertainty increases, your precision decreases, but it gives you some idea of the abundance every year. So we have a starting abundance. This is a LEC. If we look at a topographic impedance layer over here, we have 4 LECs. The square represents a fictitious plant. And now we're going to make inferences to these LECs around this plant. These are actual real LECs, but this is a plant we just put in and created the topographic impedance index there. This particular one on the east side, again, there's very little impact there from the main variable that we came out. Fine, so when we look at the before and after, they're not much different on the population abundance. This isn't growth rate, this is abundance. So our extirpation probabilities, we could look out 10 years, 30 years, 50 years, what the extirpation is. We go out to 2050, probability of extirpation. To read this graph, if it's a 50% extirpation, which we're sitting at about 35% here, then over that is greater than a coin flip that population would become extirpated in that amount of time. And this is just looping out the simulation so we can predict that based on the population growth rates and all the uncertainty associated with those growth rates. Now you can see that doesn't change. We move up to this, or we look at the rate of change before and rate of change after, still no differences there. And this is what the actual effect looks like at the plant. Now if we take this other LEC here, very similar. This LEC looks a lot different based on the growth rate before the plant, but very similar, no real effect. We are approaching 50% probability, but this is really the case for a lot of LECs in Nevada, a lot more over 50%, just in general. But we see some simplicity in the actual population based on precipitation and other factors, but really, no difference. Now let's get to a LEC where we actually see some differences here. So we get on the other side of this mountain range where that impedance layer is low impedance. Even at far distances like this, we see this oscillating population, which is very natural, and the variation in that, it's a declining population, but the extirpation probability is not too alarming, about 20%. Again, less chance of extirpation than four. And what we see after
is all that variation from our predictions is reduced because now we have a strong effect happening on that population, declining substantially. You can see what happens with the extirpation probabilities. Shoot up to a probability of 1. If we even get closer in distance, because remember our distance and our impedance are interacting, and when you have closer distance and low impedance, you have a strong, much stronger effect. And this is what ravens held at their constant median value across the state. We could work that in as well, knowing our raven density from Missouri, but I didn't do that. But you can see this effect only gets stronger when you have a closer distance. So the point here is we could actually look at the loss of grouse, how many grouse have been lost, talk in terms of that, because we know the abundance of these leks. We're calculating the rate of change. We project that rate of change over time, look at extirpation probabilities. Lots of new stuff here to allow us to understand something about mitigation. And again, using that space use abundance index that I showed earlier, we could also look at where kind of the configuration of the effect across the landscape. Okay. And the last couple slides just kind of summarize this. Basically, we have our change in abundance, or change in abundance, percent change in abundance. These are the last two effects that you saw. Those are the first two. You can see they're much stronger than the last two. Change in population growth, and then the change in the extirpation probability. That's not the actual extirpation probability. It's the percent decrease, or I'm sorry, percent increase in that extirpation. And to give you an idea of what those lambdas look like, that first leg, we went from about a 4% increase to a 3% increase. The second left, it was decreasing, but it went from a 1% to a 3% increase. But where we see the real differences are these two, over 3% to 20%, and stable to 13%. And remember, those are annual, so every year that accumulates, and with very strong decreases, and that's why we have a 78% increase in extirpation and a 99% actual excavation over a certain period. Okay, so last points here, kind of take home points. Substantial impacts, population growth rate and absent rate. Population growth rates were reduced after the impact and near the plant. The short term was a 5 kilometer. I actually took out the long term, which is the full data set, to get us out to, at this point, 8 years. We're still working at a little 10-year, but it went up to 15 kilometers, which is interesting because that means it's propagating. It's getting more overrun. And this brings in the Falcon to Gondor study. After 10 years, they were finding about 15-kilometer effects on lambda as well from that transmission. So very similar to our results from that time. The lek absent rate increased. And I want to point out, too, the Falcon to Gondor study didn't use the same methodology that we used for the first almost 10 years of study, in that they were controlling for those other environmental factors. But once they did, they found that 15-kilometer effect. We used that from the beginning. That's why we were able to capture the short-term effect at 5 kilometers. Nevertheless, using similar methodologies, slightly different, at the topographic impedance layer, we came up with recently. Lek absent rate increase after impact, 2 kilometers, evidence of negative effects on nesting survival. At low raven abundance, an increase in distance and topographic heat can increase nest survival. High raven numbers had substantial impacts, essentially flattened that plane where it negated the impacts of distance and topographic impedance of ravens are high quality. So raven and abundance and occurrence, as we brought up, is positively linked to anthropogenic subsidies. Really important for any development to take up every measure possible, I would say, to reduce raven numbers at that specific site to prevent these increases in the happening of ravens. Because they spill over too. Those are sources. Actual anthropogenic subsidies are sources for those raven populations, and then they spill over to more pristine habitat. Increase in population abundance in those areas. Research. So these decision support tools can help us actually take these models and apply them in other areas and calculate these different responses of sage grouse and predict the responses of sage grouse and make decisions about mitigation. And
Yeah, and I'd like to thank Ormap, first and foremost, providing funding for this study. Very, very helpful, and a lot of logistics out there. And like I say, great partners, and really trying to understand that Raven effect too. Unfortunately, you know, there's other effects, direct effects associated with plant and those types of things. Unfortunately, for grouse, we're identifying here so that we can make decisions about development elsewhere. And then a lot of the folks there who supported the research, logistically. I guess I could take questions here and move to the next talk.
Questions on this Raven one? So, Dr. Coates, so in working with the science work group, and maybe this is for Kelly and the team too, are they thinking that, I guess, what's the equation or what's the path forward if we do elect to try to incorporate this into the system? What's that going to look like? I mean, has anyone had that conversation or tried to wrap your head around that yet? Obviously, we can see there's an impact with anything anthropogenic that we do, but I'm trying to get three steps ahead and figure out what that's going to look like as we start putting these on the ground and participating in EISs and everything else.
Mr. Chair, Kelly McGowan, for the record, if you have some thoughts, we welcome them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have some thoughts, but I don't think you want to hear them.
That is one of the main questions that we haven't gone to yet, but we intend to try to address.
Okay.
We're learning about the science. He's been very generous in kind of training us,
mm-hmm.
teaching us. Now we need to kind of figure out how it can be incorporated into our current habitat model.
Right.
Yeah, I'm certain that it can be done, but how it looks and how it interacts with how the calculations mm-hmm. are made currently, that's going to be the challenge.
Mr. McKenzie, then I'll come to you, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It kind of sounds to me like we've always dealt with these nice, clean circles. We might not be dealing with nice, clean circles anymore.
Very good point. Yeah, it's because of the topography, which we believe. There's a lot more to it than that. How much noise is going to also influence that? This is under the condition of which Ormap had their noise levels at. But that the larger the noise, probably the greater that impedance there is going to have an impact, and the larger those irregular shaped impacts are going to occur. But I would say, back to the point of how to implement this, we can adjust that index for noise levels and project what the actual impact is on the landscape based on an adjusted noise level with that topography. Yeah, every point on the landscape will have a different shape of the effect. And that's what we're trying to get at.
Mm-hmm.
And you might have lecs that are close that are going to be unaffected, and lecs that are far that are affected. It's something that we could work into the calculation because now we have models and parameters estimated. It's just a matter of how to do it.
Mr. Swanson,
thank you. Yes, Sherman Swanson for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the connection to ravens is interesting, and at one point my brain leaped to, okay, so maybe what we do is focus our raven control methods, efforts at these places where we do geothermal, and then I flash back to the statement you'd made that Ormat already did that. So that makes me puzzled about whether this is the raven effect, which would actually relate to the death of eggs or chicks, is clearly a loss of a live sage grouse. Is there something that we could be doing there to take away that raven effect beyond what we're already doing, or is that just unreasonable?
No, those are good points. The raven effect is more ubiquitous across the landscape. It's everywhere. Even in a lot of areas where we don't have anthropogenic development, we have unnaturally high raven populations because of all the areas. The point sources like landfills are contributing really high recruitment rates and these massive transient raven groups that are out there, non-breeding, that eventually enter the breed population and set up pretty much everywhere. We're seeing this in areas where we have cliff faces and trees, where we have far more raven density than we ever had in the past. So it's not just as you mentioned, it's an interaction between raven abundance and the topography, all the effects, distance, the effects of the geothermal site. And that's what makes it actually more alarming, I would say, is even under low raven conditions, we have strong effects at the site. And this is largely because the effect of the raven is influenced by the site. And we think this has to do with behavior of the grouse. Grouse are just behaving different under those noise and light conditions that makes them more susceptible to predation. So it changes not the numerical response of that predator-prey relationship, which is just a function of how many ravens are out there, but the functional response, which is how efficient the ravens are at finding grouse. So low numbers of grouse can find, low numbers of ravens can find grouse much more effectively. Take more per capita is what we're seeing here. And we see this with the loss of habitat, too. We've actually quantified this with wildfires. When we lose sagebrush in a wildfire, even few ravens become very effective at finding themselves. But I only showed one life stage and with that really important interaction, but there, we modeled all the other life stages. We found effects across multiple life stages, and adult survival isn't impacted by ravens, yet it had, the plants have an impact on that as well. But adult survival was lower in relation to the plant, which gives us, again, more evidence. We didn't capture the raptor, but it gives us more evidence that we're also more susceptible to predation around these plants. There's also collision as well that can happen with power lines, those types of features associated with the plant. And collision cars.
So the mechanisms of those effects may possibly lead to mitigating measures that could be taken at a geothermal power plant to reduce the power of that plant's effect, negative power on sage grouse. You mentioned noise, lights. Are there other mechanisms that people are thinking about for reducing the impact of the plant on the birds?
Yeah, I would say there's a lot of utility here. Noise, light, and ravens are three of them that we've identified. This offers a way to put the plants in the right place or modify the plant's structure to where it minimizes the effects. You can do that with this tool. So in other words, well heads for geothermal, any permitting for expansion, you could design your own project that's going to have least amount of impact or low impact to sage grouse populations, as opposed to thinking about it the way that we've always thought about it in the past, which is the nice circles. You could run the model and see what makes most sense about some type of an expansion, those types of things.
So as we adjust our CCS debit system, we're probably going to need to think about those mechanisms and the degree to which they've been implemented in the plans for these potential debit projects in order to actually evaluate the number of debits that that plant gets to provide this avoid, minimize, mitigate strategy that we've been on for our whole process here.
Yeah, and I'd add the model can help do that because we could quantify it in a manner that might relate to the debits, given where the configuration of the leks, the number of birds on the leks, all of those types of factors, if it's sage-grouse-centric. There's not any types of quantification of vegetation, those types of things. It's related directly to sage-grouse. The model kind of captures all of that.
Thank you.
So one, sure, start with. As I think about what you guys are talking about, Darrell, let's put a wellhead here. And then we're going to have to move that hot water, that energy source somewhere else if we're going to try to locate the actual plant somewhere else. And I just see pipelines and disturbance, and it's just going to keep amplifying. We kind of have to go where the source is. So this is going to turn into a mathematical nightmare. So I'll go to Bev, and then I'll come over to start up. Mr. Lister, you're good?
Okay. Start a Lacey for the record. Dr. Coates, have you done any work on solar installations and their impact?
We don't have conclusions there quite yet. We have started some solar projects, but they were through the actual before data. You know, there was some change in the actual build out and infrastructure. So
just
there's going to be differences between geothermal and solar, which
But thinking about this, and you know, collectively, I mean, as a state, we're moving toward 100% decarbonization. So we should be at 50% in really just a few years' time if you think about it. A lot of the newer solar installations are also proposing battery storage, which do have a noise component because of the cooling that's required. That would be very interesting to take a look at. I think about what you said, JJ, and it's going to be very difficult. I mean, you're going to have fans, so thinking about noise attenuation, thinking about lighting that's typically security-related. So there are a lot of really interesting aspects that I think you're going to want some industry folks in here, too, to kind of talk about what might be possible. I think we need to kind of broaden our scope when we take a look at that. But this is very interesting, but I'm thinking the same things. It's like, wow, what can we do different? And then I've also wondered, you know, in a natural area where you have geothermal potential and you've got all those steam seeps, does that cause a different behavior with the birds in that area?
Yeah, and that's a good point. So I'm going to make a couple points here in response to the question. So most of the infrastructure is going to be shared across these sites in the way of grouse. Noise may fluctuate, light may fluctuate, but the actual perceived threat of the infrastructure going into those and power lines associated with the renewable energy are going to be very similar in the effect. And matter of fact, when we looked at mining, because we had a site there where we collected 5 years of post data, very similar effects to what we're finding. And now we're going to start two more mining projects. I do think that we need more research on different energy types to see if we can apply a specific energy model, like the wind model, solar model, mining model, and so forth. Those would be great. But in the absence of that, having this generalizable model is a big jump from what we previously have been doing. Now, the one thing that you brought up is these seeps and springs and the reliance that sage grouse have on those. And what's interesting is the brood rearing effects on survival were not strong. In this case, it was adult survival and nest survival. However, the change in distribution of broods was strong. In other words, they moved away from these areas a lot more. So the geothermal activity, the placement of it, is in direct competition with a lot of resources that broods need. Whereas you might not find that for solar and for wind because they're out in other typically drier environments where broods aren't going to be taking their young. So we may have different impacts in that way when it comes to source-sink dynamics. And that's another thing we've been talking about in the Sagebrush working group. And I'm going to talk about source-sink mapping and how we can identify how this index may be more corrected, if you will, in a source environment versus a sink environment. And we have maps for across the state for source-sink dynamics that we can apply as well. So in other words, the effect that we get from this can be modified by whether or not those areas or those habitats are considered sources or sinks. In this case, it's clearly a source that I showed you.
One final question, and then we'll have you go on to your next presentation. Mr. Richter.
So this is not going to be a question, Mr. Chairman, sorry. But
why am I not surprised?
So, Starla, I appreciate your question, and I'm going to tell you where my mind was here a few days ago. As I came out of Las Vegas and looked at that great big solar field that's right there at Apex. So, I don't know, back there in the late 80s, the desert tortoise was listed as threatened, and it achieved its purpose. It removed all the livestock out of tortoise habitat due to a biological opinion. Of course, the main cause of tortoises' demise was ravens, not much different than we're looking at right now. But now tens of thousands of acres of tortoise habitat have been denuded to put solar panels on. So it, in a broad context, what the impacts of geothermal are to sage grouse are irrelevant. It's all about the politics of what wants to be achieved. And so We want to keep ravens on the ground because that keeps certain groups of people happy. We want to keep renewable energy on in its abundant status because that's what makes another group of religionists happy. It's politics. It's not about sage grouse. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Hey, ready for the next president?
Sure, let's see if we can step in something a little deeper. I'm going to get my big boots on.
So,
I had a quick question. Was you guys able to capture the increase in ravens per kilometer through time after the initial disturbance?
Yes, that's what those density maps that I showed demonstrated that increase.
Okay.
And they did increase around the plant as well. I was pointing out the efforts of Ormat and trying to stop that increase.
It did happen. Okay. I didn't catch that. Thanks.
He broke it. We're going home.
Oh,
what's that?
Power plant, shiny object. Ravens.
There you go.
Yeah. Ravens.
There you go.
Okay. So I think all of what I just talked about applies to the debit side. And we will all have some mapping products to help apply. What about the credit side and conservation actions? I think this can help help us understand this. Of course, when we're trying to understand the influence of any one project, it might only pertain to that site because of all the site-level variation that exists, the factors at that site, and might not be generalizable. So we're trying to come up with a method that provides more of a tool for generalizations based on the average condition, if you will. Now, the more data we can acquire into this broad-scale look at conservation efforts, then the more we could deduce down to those different site-specific attributes on what the success is going to be. So we piloted a project in the bi-state. There's been decades of conservation actions happening there. And the idea here is to see if we can find some types of signals and estimate rate of change the same way that I talked about previously and what these populations look like with conservation efforts. The nice thing about this project is I think it shines some light on finally, on whether or not all the funding that we've been putting into conservation actions is helping. And we're going to get to that. First thing I'd like to point out here that population trends across the range, population trends across the range have been declining quite substantially. And if we look at model those declines, and we developed this targeted annual warning system, which allow us to understand where those populations that are declining are kind of decoupling from this larger spatial scale trend that's happening. This means that if it's decoupling, there's likely some local scale disturbance that's causing that decoupling. In other words, populations oscillate with large scale climatic conditions like precipitation and temperature, and if there's some type of disturbance on a landscape like loss of habitat, it influences the carrying capacity or the ability for that area to support that population, and it's not going to oscillate anymore, it's going to start to decline. And so we can look at when populations should be going up or should be going down at a certain rate compared to what they actually are doing, and there should be is the larger scale trend that's occurring with precipitation, temperature, and those climatic conditions, and isolate where those disturbances are happening. So this has been a great tool. It's allowed us to understand exactly where those specific areas are. But the questions that come out is, what kind of conservation efforts have been carried out, and are they effective in the frequency of developed populations, what types of attributes about those conservation efforts? Okay. All right, so we use data from the by state, the state population segment. There's a conservation efforts database that's been developed here. This basically is something that was put together by multiple agencies, primarily the Wildlife Service, that bring all, in a unified manner, all these conservation activities across the sagebrush biome into one repository. So we pulled from that repository. It's a great resource. We're in the process of trying to get a lot of information into this repository, but we were able to do this in the bi-state, get a lot of the data that's been, actions that have been carried out for decades there, in there, and then pull some other actions from the repository that other folks have done here. Now, we have 14,227 entries between 2006 and 2019. You see just an example of some of these efforts that we looked at. Now, these entries are individual conservation actions. They may be pieces of an action, but nevertheless, it's these in the model, and these are the different points of polygons that we're in our model. We have fence modifications, fire, that's prescribed fire, herd management, meadow restoration, fugitive removal, road block and scatter mechanical, road closure, sagebrush restoration. We're often wondering and talking about whether it's more effective to seed or plant sagebrush. Some of the trade-offs there, we look at those. Weed reduction, chemical versus mechanical, and so forth. Now we have variation in the size of the action, variation in the amount of actions that have been carried out for each of these categories. So we are able to deal with all this variation in the model and make sure that we're appropriately estimating the relative impact of each of these actions based on sometimes the overrepresentation of rescaling. In our results so that we could get a basically per unit area measure. If we look at something like PGA removal here, this is just showing one action. You've all seen plenty of probably restoration activities and so forth. But the idea here is, a lot of research have understand that this phase one enclosure, which is trees that are kind of scattered across the landscape, but still maintain primarily a sagebrush understory, still have effects on sage grouse populations. They have negative effects on survival. So what we're interested in, and we've shown that through some other research, is if we remove those trees, this is an action carried out there, do we get improvements on population growth rate through that parameter of increase in survival? We're not actually working all of the birds to see what the mechanisms there are, the process, as I discussed earlier. But we're looking at whether or not the neglect that's associated with this particular site improved on that population growth rate in a similar way that we talked about previously. So using the state-based model, basically the hierarchical model that we're using for all of our trend data, which accounts for that observation here, putting it in this before impact control design. Very similar to what we did for the impacts of geothermal, but in this case, the impact is actually the conservation action. So we could use a very similar methodology. And we also are interested in these lag effects, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 3 years. Because all actions aren't going to have immediate impact. We can hypothesize how long it's going to take, but this allows us to quantify that given the data. Similarly, you saw these ratios before. This is just a different slide showing it. But we're actually now taking the conservation effort at the scale of the conservation effort, the scale of the climate cluster, which is the bi-state as a whole, and looking at before, after, and the ratio between those two, the posterior distributions. And similarly, in interpreting these, here's something that's coupled. This means that if it's coupled, it's actually effective. Because what we've actually done is pulled the growth rate up that was declining from the conservation action to what the actual larger scale is doing, which is a sign of effectiveness there. We can't have a decrease at that site where it's still declining, or we can get an increase in that site. Very similar to what we're in interpretation of the geothermal results that I showed earlier. Now we're looking at more of this idea of an action. It's a little more complex here, though, because of these lag effects. We should expect something like this in year one, because the conservation is action is taking place in an area where perhaps the taws targeted animal warning system picked up a decline in population, but for other reasons. They're just my, for the reasons that we may come up with in stewardship groups and so forth, but there's obviously a problem at the site that needs some type of restoration. So we can assume that it's in year one, it's underperforming from the larger scale population. In year two, it might do something like this, start to outperform that larger scale population, but more likely what's going to happen is it's going to start to migrate until we see a coupling and then continue, if we're fortunate in our conservation action, to where it is fully outperforming. Now, the nice thing about this analysis, when we think about it this way, we could get the changes that occur on an annual basis, so what the average rate of change is per year, and we could also get the maximum rate of change over the given time that we study. So I'm going to be showing those parameters or those outputs as we go. See outperform in that direction. CC outperforms here. And then the conservation action outperforms on the right side. I'm bringing these figures up so that these ones will make sense because these are the results. And so just put some context to what these figures look like. And I think it's an effective way to show these figures through the posterior distributions, because again, those distributions actually represent the uncertainty in our analysis. And how much we're crossing that line, that red line there, demonstrates the probability of the, if you sum up the distribution on the right side of the line, that's the probability of success. But again, we can quantify from point to point and then overall the maximum. So the different colors are the lag effects, and I'm going to run through each of the different actions. So weed reduction, mechanical, and chemical. We have a maximum walking ratio for mechanical of 13%. This is, again, in the way of lambda. So this means that the population is growing after mechanical treatment at its maximum. The max year, 13% increases. And we found a 3.7% annual increase on average. We don't have enough data at this point for chemical in this area. Now, we're carrying out this analysis range-wide, so we'll be able to really get a lot more actions in here, probably even split more into different types of treatments and those types of things, and have a lot more years of lag effects once we expand the analysis, which is just based on the bite state. But still, gives us really positive results on the weed control. When we look at sagebrush restoration, I want to show the blue is 1 year, all the way to pink, you got blue, green, yellow, dark orange, and then pink. And notice the figures, how those posterior distributions, it's pretty remarkable, actually, that they go from blue to pink on the end, meaning that population that was associated with the conservation effort continued to increase. It didn't just maintain at some increase, but continued to increase until it outperformed the bi-state as a whole. And we saw that for sagebrush restoration. Both the seeding and the planting. But what was most important with the planting is we saw immediate effects and then some strong effects later. But seeding actually had the strongest effects over in the maximum block. And then we also have stronger effects there at 5%. And interestingly, we did another study up in Susanville area where we tracked differences between seeding and planting and actually measured the plants. And we found that that very similar to these results, that after about 4 to 5 years is where we really started to see effects of both planting and seeding, but they kind of merged on that 4 to 5 year. And we were able to obtain about 20% sagebrush cover when the plants were within a two square meter area. Which isn't typical of the BLM on restoring these landscapes. They'll spread them out a lot more, hoping for infill and dispersal of the seeds and so forth. But if you could plant them more in a patchy type of design, you could get cover much faster. But very, very similar type of results on the lag effects here. Road closure, see a very clear impact there. In 1 year lag effect, it was underperforming the climate cluster, but then eventually outperformed in a 13% maximum growth rate and a 3% average annual. PGA removal. PGA
PJ removal was had some variation in the effect. We do see mechanical, a two-year lag effect. We see this strong effect, but then it drops back down for mechanical. But we don't see that same effect when it comes to loft and scatter. We see immediate effects with loft and scatter. And we believe the reason for this, and when you go out and look at some of these sites, the mechanical treatment can have impacts on the understory and promote invasive grasses in those areas and actually change that, change the state, shrub state condition of that habitat. And so that's one reason potentially why we drop back down on performance to sage-grouse, whereas the lop and scatter technique is clearly beneficial there. And that really only pertains to that phase one encroachment. We have this isolated trees out there.
So Dr. Coates, what's your definition of mechanical?
Machinery.
So there's chaining, but then there's masticating. There's three or four different types of mechanical. I'm just wondering if there's a specific one that you're referring to.
There's no specific one. I mean, we had a lump. Unfortunately, this analysis required a lot of lumping. There's a lot of notes in the databases that actual a lot of specificity on the treatments. And I have to say, once we get a lot more data across the range, I think we could start to be more specific on those types of questions. And look at dissected loft. So this is just across the board mechanical versus on the ground, roots on the ground loft scattered at this point. Meadow restoration. What's interesting about meadow restoration is we only have, up to 4 years of data on this. It didn't actually fail in 5 and 6. But we don't see it outperforming the climate cluster quite yet. But we also know that meadow restoration takes a lot of time. And so we might be seeing something that continues to move out in years in the future. But I guess the benefit here is we are seeing some improvements in these areas, 2% annual increase. So even though it's underperforming the climate cluster, it's moving in the direction that it should be moving through time. Something that we should expect for this type of activity.
Is that also a lot of lumping and low degrees of freedom?
It could have something to do with that, but typically that's all captured. That the uncertainty is going to be captured in these posterior distributions. So if we go back to that, you can see how tight those distributions are. Pretty far to the left side of that line, but there are few sites where this activity actually occurred. And I'm sure there's a lot of variation in that too, similar to the mechanical. There's a lot of different ways to restore these meadows. And so we're just looking at whether or not those specific leks that were near the meadow restored, they outperform or not, basically.
My sense is there's even more variation in meadow restoration than there is in mechanical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. PJ treatment.
As of right now, I mean, we're just piloting this. We're shining some light on what kind of improvements we could expect from different actions in a more general sense. Oh, herd management. And this is an interesting one. Herd management, we saw almost completely impact. We only have 2 or 3 years of being in average in this case. It's we're still just below that one, but we're at about a 5% increase.
What, Dr. Coates, a herd of what?
Define what?
Change in the management.
Yeah.
And that's complete exclosure?
Yes. Exclosure to certain. Exclosures were built in an area most likely brood-rearing habitat to prevent cattle from being visited.
It'll be interesting on that one to see if you have some improvements and then have a decline.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Long-term trend on that one.
And a lot of question on the specificity. How big is that exclosure?
The average
and what are what kind of spatial, a lot of spatial factors.
So we could dig on any one of these on that, what the actual underlying notes and details about each of the projects were. And again, this is probably one where we could actually get some really good data on.
Okay.
Where we see this clear effect and it can help guide that specific action, whereas when
as we acquire more data about exposures and so forth, we might see some variation in that factor.
I would guess, even in some cases, herd management might include wild horses and burros.
Yeah, this is specific to exclosures, and they are still susceptible. Those areas would be susceptible to wild horses.
How would that happen?
Well, them moving across exclosures, if they can, if they do. There's some evidence that they can.
Go ahead, Steve.
It should be mentioned, though, there's a lot of kinds of different types of herd management that may not be fenced or exclosure. You know, we've got high-tech things going on out there now with collars and herders and a lot of things. So I think that should fall into that category.
And I think it would be interesting to talk about if it's exclosure or management, because there's also exclosures that allow grazing
deferred.
Maybe at a time mm-hmm. different or periodically. And so I think the nuance of how you have seeding versus planting for sagebrush restoration, it might be some of those nuances related to exposure. What does exposure mean? Because if it's exposure during the broodering habitat time, but they can go in later or before, because that would have different effects on the actual vegetation type that would be there, which I think is what this conversation is good.
Yeah, and yeah, all very good points. I think I want to point out, you know, any one of these topics can be an entire presentation. And I can bring in all of the data and show you exactly how the treatment occurred so that you could get a feel for why it is what it is, and it answers all these questions. But I'm trying to, you know, really show a lot of basically this process of using conservation efforts database to kind of get at what we can expect under a general condition given the underlying data. The more variation we have, the more specific we can get. And so, like that as well, movement of cattle, you know, time of grazing, duration of grazing, all of these factors can be looked at. And I'm hoping that, you know, with range-wide analysis, which we've just funded to do, we'll be able to get a lot more data on those types of things. And we're going to have variation across the range, too. So this is why I think it's really important for every conservation action to get uploaded into that database so that we have more power to look at how effective these actions have been. Again, this is sage-grouse centric, based on a sage-grouse population locally, not necessarily in vegetation, say, on the restoration activity, but what the response of sage-grouse was to that activity.
One of the much earlier slides showed that the average size of the herd management exclosures was 5 hectares, I guess, so about 10 acres. So I'm guessing they actually are exposures.
Yeah. Okay. And so we could, that slide kind of summarize a little bit about the sizes of these activities, but there's a lot of variation. Fire. So we saw some positive influences of fire as well. But again, we did see this kind of backtrack. It goes up and then it goes back down. We think that might be because of the variation where the prescribed fire occurs. In some areas where it probably should not have been carried out, and then cheap grass, a transition to an annual grassland environment, whereas some areas may have been perfectly fine for the fire to be carried out. The immediate response we get from fire is probably because of an increase in forbs associated with that, just immediately following the burn, which offers a lot more food sources for the brooding grouse, and may end up with a higher recruitment rate, but eventually over time, not be such a great thing to see across this. And we also have a lot of other analyses and data that we're conducting with wildfire that demonstrates that similar effect outside of the United States. Fences. And this is the reduction of fences. No fences, there's some potential collision, but they also may be predator traps. As these birds are moving about the landscape, they sometimes run before they fly. They can move into a fence. Sometimes you get a lot of build-up vegetation under the fence, get caught up there, and get captured by a predator, so forth. So there's a lot of other types of effects that we're not always thinking about with fences, but a very clear effect on the population. Fences are near butts. And this is probably primarily due to collision, because a lot of the fences that were taken down are direct relation to those effects. And a lot of birds are moving on and off the ducks during those twilight hours, which offers opportunity for collision.
So, Pete, was that fence removal or modification, flagging, everything?
Fence removal.
Strictly removal.
There may have been modification, may have been lumped in. I'd have to
okay.
look at that.
Okay.
Because I know there was some modifications done, flagging and that kind of stuff in that very disease.
Okay.
But there, most of it, it's been fence removal.
Okay.
So the good news is, when you look at this collectively, just about conservation actions, I mean, there's been over $46 million allocated to conservation actions in the bi-state. And the bi-state, you know, this is on a different trajectory as far as listing decision and many other types of processes like management plans and so forth. And we see something different there. We've actually seen higher population growth rates overall compared to the Great Basin as a whole, but most recently, in up to the 2021 trend analysis, bi-state has reversed its trend, and it's now starting to increase. I don't have that for you today, but I will next time I'm here to show the range-wide trends and what the bi-state and the different areas of the Great Basin look like in relation to the range-wide. But bi-state is potentially out of this population nadir, which is a low point, starting to ramp back up. The last 2 years have been population growth. And it could be due to the large per capita rate of conservation actions here. In other words, for the amount of area compared to anywhere in the range, the most amount of conservation efforts have occurred by state. And what we've actually seen is about a 1% increase, the weighted average. Now, weighted average is based on all of them. Different lex sizes and the actions associated with them. A 1% increase over time, which is now a percent of 1.1 for the year. So this, again, accumulates over time and increasing this population, increasing the population size.
Peter, did you consider the conservation efforts on the Gunnison compared with bi-state?
That's interesting. We haven't looked at that. I'd like to work with those folks, and because there has been a lot of conservation actions there as well. Actually, just was at a Gunnison symposium, gave a couple talks about ravens and wildfire, and there were a lot of restoration on wet meadows there. Some really, really great stuff. A lot of translocation actions as well. But yeah, that would be really good to look at. I think there's been more done in the bi-state, just from what I could anecdotally see between the two and with discussions with folks. But it would be interesting, yeah, to look at that. And I'm hoping that we're expanding this greater sage grouse range wide, but I'm hoping that we can include Gunnison in discussion.
So am I reading this right on the lower purple line that's headed down? That's mechanical weed reduction?
You are reading that. That's actually chemical.
That one's the chemical one. Yeah. Okay. And so that's showing us that that's harmful or just that it's not helpful?
Well, I would say it's inconclusive because okay. That's the one that only has 1 year of data.
Oh.
So when we're thinking about these lag years, there's really not enough information. It's still declining. But it could track up with more years of data, which is going to shift that slope. And to be fair, that line probably shouldn't be shown because it's only 1 year. This is a trend. But all these other points we have data to at least look at these trends. And again, these will shift with more data through time, and they're not linear. But if I were to actually fit the actual trends, these days, it'd be very scrambled. So this gives you the general. Information about slopes. But what we see here is, you know, some of the strongest effects coming from the PGA lop and scatter techniques, the sagebrush restoration, which are the green dashed lines there, very strong. The actual black line, the solid black line, that's the median value between all of them. And so that's just showing that the LECs that have had actions are improving rapidly, annually, and over time more than the ones without actions, and outperforming the larger mice state climate cluster.
Makes sense.
So one way that we've been talking about in the science work group is how to incorporate maybe the change in population growth, again, applying that to the LEC sizes that we have out there. We could do very similar types of predictions about growth into the future of these LECs, given some conservation action, and look at how it reduces the extirpation probability, for example, of these LECs as well. So we have now the kind of the tools on the conservation side. Again, there's a lot of nuances here on the type of action, but that's probably going to just slightly change the positive effect, whether it's the different types of wet meadow restoration, different types of mechanical treatment on PJ, rather than influence that overall positive trend. So it provides some information.
Do you have a question, Kelly?
And I was just going to say this is really important messaging because it indicates that where dollars are spent on conservation, there is a positive influence on the population. And, we have some PMUs in the greater sage-grouse area, that are equal to the size of the bi-state. And, if we could get some idea as to the amount of dollars that may be necessary to help us change the trend. I think that's pretty important messaging that people understand that, we're in deep here and we need significant investments, not just through mitigation, but, collectively to be able to turn the tide, so to speak.
Yeah, and I guess the another question that would come up is where can you be effective without your action?
Yep.
Because again, back to this lambda value, a lambda on 100 birds means something entirely different than a lambda on 10
right.
birds. It's the same population growth rate. And then we need to think about sources versus sink populations. Sources are those that are losing migrants that are supporting other populations, and periphery sinks are those that are pulling in migrants but still have low demographic rates and perhaps reducing population size.
Hang on one second. Sure, Megan was going to go.
I had a quick question. On spatially, these actions related to LECs, was there a difference of the types of projects in relation to, so I guess, is distance or was distance calculated? Because I think that would be interesting to see it within each one of those actions, knowing the distance and its positive or negative impact, or how great that positive impact would be interesting to help demonstrate or encourage activities related to, okay, so yes, doing PJ removal is great, but it's better at this distance versus this distance, so that when people want to do conservation actions or the agencies are trying to decide when to do and how to do project work, if there's distance factors that can help move that trend so that we're doing things hopefully in a more positive way sooner. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. A lot of that gets answered with the previous talk as far as the effect,
right.
But the action you can model in a very similar manner, which is what the conservation planning tool that I showed before. I have a little bit to show on that as well. It takes into consideration distance from the PJ treatment area to the LAC.
But from an actual results perspective,
right.
I think it'd be fascinating from
absolutely.
This suite of sort of activities.
Yeah. What we did was, these are all actions related to a specific distance around the LAC. It was a 10-kilometer distance around the LAC, where we looked at all the different actions, and some of them have multiple actions. But we were able to, in the model, show all the structure of the model, complex, but parse out the variation associated with each action so that we're not confounding one action. We're able to account for it that way. As far as getting to your point, we weren't able to look at actual covariates associated with that action population. Again, more data. We will be able to do those things. This kind of restricted.
Goes into effect July 24th.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, looking at your your vertical axis proportional change in the Bakke ratio suggests to me that if we were declining in the bi-state area, then we may have a positive change away from declining, but we may not actually be increasing the populations yet. We just have had a positive effect from the investment of the conservation efforts.
Exactly.
Do we know whether we're having that positive effect on the net population?
Really good question. And that's a good observation. The one on this isn't the population rate of change. It's actually the rate of change relative to the climate cluster. So it's that population. So you're outperforming the climate cluster to get there in the 1.1 region, but still declining. That's your point. And that's why I brought up the population in the bi-state is now increasing the last 2 years. We're actually in the positive. We're over one on land over the last 2 years. I don't have those results. We just finished. It's preliminary. We just finished. Still need to get the review, running trends for the entire range. And that's what we're doing. Bi-state. It's the only area other than eastern Wyoming. There's only two areas in the entire range that have changed trajectory, and the bi-state is going to be all of our sites.
And is that positive change in trajectory adjusted for weather?
All of the trends the trends are largely driven, the cyclicity in those trends are driven by weather patterns. But what we're seeing is when you come down to these lower points, we call them population nadirs in the cycles. They're typically during drought years, and the bi-state gets more precipitation in a lot of areas of the Great Basin, obviously. But it has been largely dry in the last decade since 2012. Really. But we are seeing from those points of precipitation that have happened there that the positive growth associated with those is helping us come out of the nadir. So the idea here is, if you have loss of habitat, sometimes these populations, because the carrying capacity or ability for that population to recover has been reduced, you don't have the habitat there anymore, they can't track that precipitation and continue to deep. And that's what we're seeing in a lot of the range. So where we should be seeing positive effects of precipitation, we're actually seeing still declining populations because of loss of habitat. The difference kind of between this stochasticity associated with precipitation, the deterministic effect of removal of habitat. Wildfire is a pretty good example of that. Bi-state, arguably, we're making better habitat. So we're increasing the carrying capacity. So it allows that population to pull back up because you're restoring habitat. You're allowing, a larger a number of birds to function on the landscape. By, all these actions here, the trees and so on. Does that make sense?
Yes, although I remember a previous slideshow, there was a large density dependence factor on sage grouse as well. So what you just said suggested just the opposite, that when we have low populations, it's harder to recover, and yet a strong density dependence would suggest that we plateau when we get too many birds.
Yeah, and it gets complex with grouse. So there's, with sage grouse, there's something known as inverse density dependence, or largely driven by the effect. Once they cross a certain threshold on size, it becomes a function of the number of birds where they can't really. Think about a population that's declined down to 10 individuals. You have a population growth rate at its max of 30%. You could acquire 3 birds from that population. Whereas a population of 30, which is still not at its max, let's say the max carrying capacity is 60, 70, 80 birds, it's increasing. An increase in that 30% allows you 9 more birds to increase. So you're still on that upward trajectory, but with more birds, you're going to grow at that maximum rate of growth much faster. And that's the problem. with sage grouse is a small population paradigm where they get so small they can't recover. And we're seeing that even under great habitat conditions. It takes many, many years of a maximum growth rate, which would mean that many, many years of precipitation line up in order to get back up to that initial.
Steve, and then I'll go to you, Willie.
I've been trying to wait. Oh, here.
Get the questions out so we can move.
But you touched on something that I wanted to ask. In the areas that I'm familiar with, and you are also, we're seeing population numbers very, very low, extremely low. And as it relates to predation, is my question. The bird numbers, the population is going down. The raven numbers are steady, maybe going up a little bit. But it seems to me that there's a threshold where the intensity of predation on fewer number of birds, nests, eggs, intensifies because there's fewer out there and those birds have to eat. And of course, where I'm going is there's a common denominator to me through everything we're talking about today. And in most cases, that's predation and that's ravens. And that's the elephant in the room. And we've got all this amazing data with grazing habitat that is unbelievable. I mean, we have on our allotment, almost 90-some% of the meadows protected. We have good habitat. In some areas, pristine. That does not guarantee we're going to have birds. And it's frustrating because I watch this every day. If we put even a little more effort into control, it just doesn't seem like we're doing it. And I'm not... We can't take advantage of all this amazing data and what we're looking at, what we've done, and the money we spent until we deal with that issue. What I'm saying, but it is frustrating because I've watched the population. And, in our case, we've had these subsidies and this transmission for about 30-some years, and we've just seen this decrease, this decline in these populations. And I worry we're going to lose it. Some areas we'll probably see what's going on in the bi-state. In some of these other areas, I'm afraid we're not going to, unless we deal with that.
Maybe, Pete, before you, because my question is related. I've been hanging around with Steve too much, I guess.
I'm going to separate you two at dinner from now on.
Well, I guess it might be a little difficult to call raven control a conservation action, but... And obviously, it's not a habitat relationship, but did you evaluate that? Has there been raven control in conjunction with these other conservation actions there?
We have evaluated as a separate study. There has been none in the bi-state. Most of the bi-state is in California, and Vermont is quite a bit more areas it is in the bi-state. But nevertheless, it wasn't really in the conservation efforts database. We've evaluated it. Multiple sites. One is Steve's area. That's what I did my dissertation on many, many years ago, back in the early 2000s. But we've recently done a study in the Virginia Mountains where we've been able to do that before after controlled impact design. And we're finding a strong effect there of increases in population. We're not the only ones. There's evidence from all around the range. Large scale studies looking at lack improvements when you have a lethal removal associated with those lax peoples. Did a study on that, showed improvements. John Dinkins has done a study similar to what we did at Boyce Ranch many years ago, where he found very similar effect. Matter of fact, very similar threshold, 0.4 ravens per square kilometer. So, yeah, it's obviously conservation for sage grouse based on the data if you are removing subsidized predator in that environment. But I would argue also that habitat is, and we can't, ecology is complex because the variables are interacting with each other. So it's just based on all the studies I've done, you can't categorize habitat away from predators and actually, make this dichotomy where it's either one or the other. When you lose your habitat, ravens become more efficient at finding nests. So we see this in wildfire sites. We see when we lose cover down around 50% below, ravens become much more effective. We published a paper on that, on the odds of predation. more ravens in the environment, you could have the best, as Steve's point is, the most pristine habitat out there, and you could drive nests around the populations down to a way that they can't recuperate through the maneuvering stage and adult survival stage of the population growth. And we have a paper out that demonstrates that as well. And that's when we get those raven numbers down, you know, up to that, above that 0.4 square kilometer threshold. Of course, that impacts on population. But I guess back to Sherm's point and yours, and just combine these, we do have precipitation patterns that influence vegetation. That vegetation provides concealment from ravens. And ravens are the most proximate factor influencing. But it ultimately gets back to these abiotic precipitation and biotic vegetation factors that influence that relationship. What we think about is the carrying capacity, which is how much vegetation supports it, is in the absence of, under normal predation circumstances. Now, if you were to, you could have a high carrying capacity, but the numbers of sage grouse being held at a very low number continue to plummet until they are extirpated, as your point is, Steve. And the reasoning is because predators, when they hit a certain number, can limit that population from reaching its maximum potential given the habitat. And that's what our next, you know, one of our next studies, we're bringing all this stuff together, is really going to illustrate. So I don't, like I said, I don't think you really focus on just one or the other. So getting the point of conservation actions, they should probably be all on the table as they're all including population. Okay. Any other questions here? Should we move on?
Let's move on, sir.
Actually, I have some nice slides that demonstrate that reduction in carrying capacity due to loss of habitat and some of the data we've quantified to get at that, and how the cycles that sage grouse populations experience that are driven by precipitation and temperature start to reduce in amplitude. And those cycles become smaller and smaller, largely because that population ceiling is going down, driving that population down. Where some of the most pristine areas, we're doing an analysis now where we're looking at core sagebrush areas in the range using the sagebrush integrity index. And within that core area where there's very few disturbances on the landscape, we see very neutral oscillating populations because of precipitation patterns. So pretty interesting. Okay.
I was just going to add that I think, you know, as we kind of triage our approaches, and we know there's a lag time when we, for most habitat or conservation efforts, there's probably some level of lag time, that in the interim, this predator control could help us at least maintain populations or until we get the habitat conditions kind of recover to the point where maybe we can back off on a predator control, but
it's hard chairs.
Do you think that is an approach that should be taken, not everywhere, but in specific areas?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of contention around predator removal, and it's obviously obviously for public debate, not to the public really to decide, and the agencies which they represent. But there's a lot of other ways to manage raven populations, and one of the big ones is through anthropogenic substances. And so what we're coming up with is a tiered type of management process where, depending on the density of ravens at a site and what the sage-grouse populations are based on these type of mapping products, nesting habitat, size of the nest, source, sink, those types of things, would determine what tier you're in. And the first tier being habitat improvement, as you're talking about, which again mitigates the predation effect. If you're losing habitat, fewer predators can be really effective. But if you have the right habitat and not a real strong subsized population of predators, you could maintain minimize the predation rates for sage grouse. Steve said something interesting, that when these populations get low, that they become more susceptible because there's so fewer of them out there. And that's true for sage grouse because there's not a lot else out to eat at that time of year. We're talking February and March when these birds start nesting. Rodents haven't appeared. You don't have a lot of other food for ravens. And if the habitat isn't in place, their search image is pretty good, and they can find the few nests that are out there, which wouldn't typically be a case for a lot of other animals. The density dependence starts to work in that case, and you have some refugia for those ones that are at smaller populations, and they start to increase. But ravens have the potential to drive into extirpation. So under those conditions, it would move you to a different tier. The second tier being anthropogenic subsidy reduction, which is where your densities are approaching that 0.4 ravens per square kilometer. But if you're well above that, your uncertainty is very minimized. You've got strong confidence in your effect, and you've moved to potentially tier three, which is more of a direct type
That's
of
why thing. I think that
egg oiling, nest removal, raven removal, all of those applications that directly go up to
the last animals in the water.
That's something we're proposing. We have another paper coming out in a raven special issue on that management process and adequate workshops on it. Good point. Okay.
That's why we need cows.
Should I move on here, or any other questions on? All right, I know we're running late. I'll move through this fast. Okay. Very quickly, I'm going to take you back in time on some of our products, show you some of the new ones. I probably won't show the actual automated conservation planning tool. Maybe that's another talk, but I'll just show you the interface environment. But basically, we started out back in 2013-14 developing maps to inform our conservation program system, as well as the land use amendments and so forth, and the BLM. You remember we had these annual habitat maps come out, and they looked something like this. We combined space use abundance indices with predictions of habitat based on covariates on the landscape, on disproportionate use to availability. In other words, where are grouse going because of the environmental conditions, coupled with where they actually are, based on our lek count and modeling that we get from that lek count. The red areas you see there are the space use stuff, where we have high space use and we have high habitat conditions, and that's considered for these other management categories. That was our initial map. We knew we needed seasonal maps to inform different aspects of the credit system, as well as the BLM's approaches. So we developed these seasonal maps. We combined, space use abundance indices. And we brought in a lot more information. This was by 2018. Remote sensing has gotten a lot better at this point. Instead of using land fire data, which is 30-meter resolution, binary 0 or 1 on a cover type, we now have information where we get a percent pixel at that 30 meters from Homer's lab and a lot of other folks. And so we get this much higher resolution of sagebrush. We also developed a conifer map statewide, which was largely funded by this program, to come up with a much better rendition of that mapping. Now, we published a paper on this, and
what this showed, we had an open pollen report 2016 and paper in 2018. We'll show some variation across regions based on mesic and xeric habitat and these different environmental factors. I was going to talk about this slide more in depth, but I'm going to just skip over it in the interest of time. But it allowed us to look at the spatial variation and the actual covariates there. Nevertheless, we got these spring, summer, winter maps that were combined into an annual habitat suitability index, which is now being used, across multiple plans for conservation credit system. And then we could also develop these categorized maps that will have high water, low habitat for spring, summer, and winter. Now, the important thing about these mapping products is they're based on telemetry data, thousands and thousands of telemetry points from multiple studies and just some monitoring that many folks have done in South Dakota to develop these, but they only get a selection. And this can be misleading because we have a changing environment and grouse do not adapt very quickly to these changes. Matter of fact, they don't even adjust very quickly at all to these changes. So the adaptation is almost is very, very, very slow for this rapid changing environment. So this leads to problems. They may select for a certain area. They may have a response to go back to a specific area like fidelity, which worked in the past when these landscapes weren't changing so quickly. But without change, it decreases their survival rates. So they're making decisions that basically aren't working for them because the landscape's changing so rapidly. So in order to understand that, we need to bring in success maps, which we haven't begun to do at this stage. So that our next rendition of this, and I think I showed some preliminary data on this, but now we've published two papers, one in the Journal of Climate Change Biology and another in Global Ecology and Conservation, which was some nice journals to get this information into. We did this life stage mapping, looking at nest survival, brood survival, and how that relates to selection of these areas. This helps us get at source sink dynamics. The reason is because where you have high selection and you have high selection survival in an area like that, grouse are attracted to that area, and they propagate in that area because their survival probabilities are higher. So these are sources, they're considered source habitats. Now, those are important to identify because we also have areas where they might have high selection but low survival, and those would be considered sinks. The landscape changed for whatever reason, or it's just not working for the grouse, and grouse aren't doing well in those areas. If you have enough source habitat in a population, defined by the boundaries of which that population moves, and it's there's no immigration, which we've developed neighborhood clusters to get at that, then those populations can become source populations. They're bringing in more individuals and they're losing. Whereas if you have a lot of sink habitats within a population, then those can be sink populations. So we're trying to understand where those occur in the state. These source habitats and sink habitats and source populations and sink populations. So we can make better decisions about where to go for conservation actions and where effects might be more strongest. I'm going to skip through the field methods, and we brought in a lot more and better environmental covariates. We're using basically the most cutting-edge stuff that's available to us, both from USGS and many other sources, some of which we're developing, others we're relying on our colleagues. The percent cover, for example, is now back in time. We have it going back every couple of years, back to when Landsat, 1970s, 1980s, I think it's actually 80s, where it got reliable enough for this. So we're not dealing with a static mapping. We're looking at those changing, that changing environment and how the grouse is either selecting that or not, and it's surviving under the conditions of which occurred back then, which we weren't able to do in the previous cells. We're bringing in other types of things, wetness indices, which is a measure of soil moisture, topographic roughness, and so forth, transmission lines. Just a lot of stuff. We're looking at different scales. That's just a few of the variables that we're included in here. And some of the effects, I'll go through these kind of quickly, but I want to just basically demonstrate the path of the product, because a lot of biology
that they could, you know, harvest for decision making. But these grouse are selecting areas with higher herbaceous cover, more big sage, not surprising, greater sagebrush height, a little bit higher in elevation for nesting. So these are our selection curves. And again, with these parameters, we could actually develop these mapping products on the side by making predictions across the landscape, even where we didn't monitor grouse, based on those parameters. So we end up with a nesting resource selection function there, which we hadn't had in the past. So this is specific to nesting birds. We do now have a resource selection function for that season, but that includes non-nesting females and males, and then we have our nesting map. And so you can take those two maps and kind of see what the whole population needs during the season, but what specifically is important for reproduction in the way of selection. We've also done this for survival, which is something new here, where we can look at how these different covariates include survival, greater shell cover, lower cumulative burn area, and more topographic rugged landscape resulted in higher nest survival. Some of the biology curves here, and the mapping product on the survival side. I'll talk about us combining those in the maps in just a moment. But what's interesting here is we have this misalignment between selection and survival. In that they're selecting for this herbaceous cover. I'm going to show this in broodering stage two. Sometimes when these fires occur, we get a lot more herbaceous cover, and the birds will go into those areas and nest into those areas. But because the cover lacks sagebrush, it has a, and within that boundary of the fire, which is, means that we remove a lot of sagebrush, it has a negative consequence on survival. Now, we saw this at this landscape perspective. We actually did some Bakke analyses in areas where we have fires to get more of the mechanisms of that. They are choosing sites they've chosen in the past of which, and their offspring are, of which the sagebrush have been removed. Again, back to this idea that they just don't adjust to these landscapes very well. And this is a maladaptive behavior that they have, an ecological trap. But it ecological trap is a form of a sink, so it's formed a sink habitat for this, where you have high selection and low survival. And as we all know, you get some cheatgrass in the system, it burns, and then you can it may transition over, likely will transition over to monoculture cheatgrass from that shrub state to an annual grass state. And birds will continue to nest in there. Now, when we look at brood rearing, we see some similar type of effects, different, you know, these are similar to some different stuff here. They're selecting for communal grass, dwarf sagebrush, slope elevation, they're closer to springs and wet meadows. Things that we hypothesized would be the case came out really strong. So then we can take these types of things and even model selection. Now, again, interestingly, these are patterns we would expect grouse to do because this is behaviorally what they've predicted in many other studies and what we know them to do. But when it comes to survival, we have some maladaptive traits happening. This is where it's a little maybe misleading if we're looking at just selection maps. Well, I'm going to point out this figure. This is actually a three-dimensional figure, but you have early blue selection. It's low selection at the red color and high selection at the blue color. On the survival side, low survival on the red, high survival on the blue. And then you have your two variables on what that looks like. Annual grass on this axis, bird area on this axis. So basically, with more annual grass, we have higher selection, no matter how much bird area. You can see that with the blue streak right there. And that's this, pointing out this here, high, even under these high fire burned area conditions. Well, in that burned area, we have very low survival. It's actually the lowest point across that entire continuum, that entire plane. So they're moving into these burned areas in the early brood rearing period, and it's not right. It's so again, kind of ecological trap. We see something similar for late brood rearing, where it's low selection, low survival, but they're moving out of those burned areas that during that late brood rearing, there's higher selection for that annual grass, which is outside of the burned areas, and this is the inner spacing of the annual grass. It actually works for these birds. See that it's not having such an impact on survival to use that on that annual grass, although the impact is there. And again, we could map this survival across the entire state, where we could expect roots to do really good versus poor on a survival, from a survival standpoint. And where areas that have transition animal grass, maybe it's survival, lack of shrub cover, lack of food resources for chicks. We understand all of that. But what's interesting is without CBA, I think grass had some benefits. The CBA was generally positive on average, largely because this is without annual grass, because it provides this full release, and then you have a nice sagebrush structure from it. So if it's not going to be subjected to annual grass invasion, then it could actually work for these birds. Something else that we know to be true, because fire's been around thousands of years. It's just a matter of how it's changed the environment, the annual grass frequency, duration, and so forth. Okay, getting to source sink habitat mapping, where we could take these mapping products and combine them. Basically, what we're doing is we're looking at, now you can't read this axis, very small screen, very small writing, but I'll point it out. Basically, the blue areas here represent high selection, high survival. Those are the best areas. Those are source areas for nesting. The red areas are concerning. That's high selection. Grouse will use those areas. They'll go there for nesting, but they have very low survival based on the conditions. It was actually aligned really well with the burn map, if you look at that, but other types of loss of sagebrush disturbance of the landscape. Did the same thing for blueberry, sourcing map there. It looks a little different from the nesting, but we have this high selection, blue high survival, and red. Low survival, but still high selection. And then, everything in between here, like low selection, low survival, obviously is not habitat. So, but we just have more tools to work with now as far as what works for grouse.
So, Pete, on that one, you've got several of those concentration areas that are showing in the high selection, low survival. Am I reading it right?
You're reading that right.
Okay. Yeah. The conclusion here is they're a really dumb bird.
Think Darwin.
They are a primitive lineage bird. A corvid has a definitely a more cognitive.
They're just a dinosaur.
Ravens. That's, why it makes it so interesting when you hit a raven against a sage grouse.
Taking a knife to a gunfight.
Okay, so the application here. The results of this study helped inform management plans and quantification tools in a way that aligns with orders of selection by sage grouse and with the guide management efforts. For example, this is just one example of fire suppression, or fire management, just to kind of demonstrate an example, bringing in this nesting sourcing map. We found that nesting actually is the stage of which is most impacted by wildfire. Adult survival is turning out to be as well, but chick survival a little less so. Saw a little bit of results there from early brood rearing stage. But, nesting is really it gets back to the whole discussion over efficiency of predator finding that prey in a low crop environment and so forth. But if we take those concentration areas and getting to the point here on how to use this within those areas, it's going to blend up nicely. And we bring in all that information about high selection and high survival. These are actually the areas that came out strong for grouse within the concentration areas. So there were some areas in there that kind of are working for grouse. And these might be the areas where we're thinking about the most amount of preservation. So anything we can do to suppress fires, fuel breaks, pre-suppression activity, whatever it might be, reduction in fuels, those types of things that really help help these areas from a wildfire standpoint be prevented from burning. They are serving as contributing to the survival performance of the population. However, these areas where we have grouse still selecting them, and this is largely in Great Basin contributing to decline in grouse, are the low survival areas. This might be really targeted restoration activities. Planting and seeding using the conservation efforts database type of study that I talked about earlier. We could help guide those strategies on what works best for grouse, along with other studies that are out there.
Or focused predator management.
That's right. If that's the decision to make. A combination of both. Obviously, you know, using the tiers to kind of get at what the best solution might be based on that environment, how many ravens are out there, and what the habitat conditions look like. That all falls into that tiered approach. Identifying fragmentation. This is something that is really neat that we haven't been able to do in the past. We've talked a lot about how far is the brood habitat from the nesting habitat. Can we figure out a way to develop corridors to help improve the movement of these birds across the landscape? Or how do we, if the landscape is conducive to it and it's just lost it for whatever reason, disturbances, how can we get it back to that pre-disturbance condition where the brood habitat existed, where nesting habitat existed? So this gives us tools there. For example, we can look at all stages, nest, early brood, late brood, nest, early brood, late brood, across the entire state. A really nice tool here, zeroing in, you can see the level of detail that you could get in any specific site. Something else that it would be really good to incorporate into these tools, quantification tool. What we're doing next is trying to understand how much of each of these habitats is needed for population growth and the configuration, and is the reduction in sources versus sinks, the amount of that quantification influencing the population growth rate of these birds. So we have the covariates now in these maps to look at the actual decreases and increases in population size associated with this type of help and support covariates. Okay, so that's what this basically was. Identify areas of greatest loss of habitat and wildfire fragmentation incorporated. So all of this will be incorporated in the conservation planning framework. Really quick, similar trajectory in the bi-state. A little bit different approach. So we have these two maps. We're now at the life stage mapping in the bi-state. Lots of different biological factors identified. Don't get into the interest of time, but the biology there, that everything really makes sense. It's interesting to have our selection side, our survival side, across all the different life stages. That's what the four maps are. And then we could also develop the source sink maps there, which we've made for bi-state. Some different factors came out, and this is where we're going with the whole thing. All of that to this point has been, for the most part, published. This has not. We're still in the stage here. Bi-state, we're still putting the paper together too. But this is where we could look at the selection across the different life stages, and then selection survival in one solid map here that expresses the sourcing dynamics across all the life stages. And that's where that last product is going. That would be a composite of all the different reproductive phases on sourcing. Again, these are pixels, so they're quantifiable and can be used in something like the tools that you're developing. Okay, conservation planning. You've heard me speak to this before, but this is an environment where we actually now take these mapping products. We have all the models that predict what that habitat is now from the selection and survival side. So now we could change the environment, simulate the change, and then re-predict it on the landscape. And with the survival stuff, it's really important to incorporate that. Subtract the differences before the actual management application and after, and see what our improvement is to that population. Predict that improvement. And then you do your next project. You can simulate and design projects in the conservation planning environment using these models. Now, it's really difficult to do this in a way that it all has done manually. So we have developed a web-based application so that anybody can do it. There's on the back end, there's all GIS data stored in the R package. So everything's stored there. CPT steps are documented and executed by customized functions. So we've developed packages or functions that actually do all the analysis for the user. They don't have to see any of it, it just runs it all. And those will be publicly available through GitLab. on the front end where the application user exists, they interface with the developer through this R-Shiny software, connected to some CDP software. Users can parameterize matrix simulations with simple drop-down menus, web app will be listed in the USGS. So basically, you'll have drop-downs, what your management action is. You can draw polygons, you can import polygons, and see what your outcomes are for that specific site under using that management application. So I'm just going to move through this quickly. We've had this first rendition, which I think you've seen on the CPT. We've completed a study on sagebrush or sagebrush growth on seeding and planting strategies across the sagebrush biome. But a lot of the data came out of, some of the data came out of seeding, but some of the planting, more important planting data came out of that. So we used this information to incorporate in the conservation planning tool. So when you do, for example, a seeding project, it will take on the values associated with our study here to grow vegetation over time. And then apply the models, the selection of survival models, to that new landscape to provide you with an output of what the benefit sage grouse are. So that's just some of the information that goes into this. This is what the CPT interface looks like. I've got a few of these simulations. I'm not going to run through all of them, but well, in the interest of time, basically you can go through and you could do these different drop-down menus, restoration timing, drinking metric, so you get different outputs, restoration type, whether it's a wildfire, passive recovery, seeding, planting. This next graphic would show, you can't really see it anyway because it's really small, so I'm just going to move on here. There's lots of options here. You can upload your data, you can draw on it, you get your outputs, a lot of run simulations. We're working on this. That one will be released this fall. We're releasing the bi-state one in the next month, and then this one will be released this fall, but we're already working on 2.0, which brings in the selection and the survival mapping that I showed earlier, because we just finished all of that up. So now we're building that in. It's going to be a quick release on that. We're thinking like spring of 2023, where there'll be a lot more built into it than the original version. The original version is only selection. It's based on our mapping products in 2018. So I'm just going to skip a lot of these slides. And you can see this is the second version where we have life stage of interest, nest, early brood, late brood, full brood, and so forth. So you can bring that information up. And here's a timeline for when we'll be releasing the conservation planning tools. And these will be, like I say, anybody can use them. They don't actually consist of data. You can't pull sagebrush locations per se. But you can draw any restoration activity and then run that project and see what your predictive output is. Modify the project, rerun it, run multiple projects at once, rank them all. There's different options like that. Okay, and that was the mapping update and planning tools. Any questions?
Quick statement. I just keep thinking of Tina, and she always said it's not just doing something, it's doing something in the right place when she was sitting in. And this gets it so much closer to that, and it's going to be such a valuable tool, the CPT, and to help you guys too. I mean, if there's a proposed credit project somewhere, that desktop, and you know, you're looking at it here, well, this is what we think you might get, that's going to help so much more figure this out. It's going to be a very valuable tool. So that's pretty excited about that one. Bevan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Pete, really early on in that bunch of slides that you were skipping through, Right, one caught my eye in that series of boxes, and one of them was distance to spring. I think it was one that caught my eye. How much of that kind of analysis has gone into these products as far as distance to water source? And I'm going to preface that with something I've talked about before. At least in my country, prior to the Wild Horse and Burro Act, there were windmills and pump jacks and stuff that were run pretty well continuously. There was water there year-round. With the advent of horses and non-management, livestock were managed differently, and those waters were shut off part of the year. Most of them are in disrepair, and there's no water there now. My question is how is distance to water, how does distance to water affect distribution of sage-grouse?
Well, it came out as a strong variable, both selection and survival at specific life stages. Brood-rearing stage, it was the strongest, obviously.
Sure.
We didn't model, we haven't modeled survival. I actually skipped past the slide that talked about the next steps on mapping, because we're not quite done. We still are going after winter and adult survival, so we'll be looking into the parameters of that. That it may come out there at specific times of year. But yeah, it's really important in that brood rearing stage, distance to water source. Now, the water sources that we used here are those of which we had GIS information for. And a lot of the ones you're talking about, we just don't have that information. So there could have been birds, you know, back in, 10 years ago, that were using those sources, and they're going to be pretty far from the natural source of water, and it's going to add air into our analysis under those conditions. But we did find a strong effect, so obviously they're using those natural sources quite a bit. That supplementary water was probably really important for one of those populations. So, as we see, like in a study in Long Valley, where we don't have a lot of natural water, a lot of water from LADWD is being pushed to Los Angeles, kind of greater area, and pulled out of that. We used to irrigate those pastures quite a bit back in 2005 to 2012, even before that. But since the drought hit, same reasons you're talking about, they quit irrigating pastures, and we've seen Long Valley populations drop substantially. There's not a natural water source to get up those high elevations where water exists. For those reasons, water is important, supplementary or natural.
And I guess I would leave that with you as a thought in that I know in the Lincoln County area there are a lot of inactive lefts. And I would, and I'm talking 30 years ago, and I would really look carefully at the location of those lecks in relation to where there might have been those, subsidized water sources or non-permanent water sources that are no longer available.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd like to look into that for sure.
Chris?
Along those lines, the Guzzler program probably is enhanced. That expansion too. I mean, you're getting the same thing where you've lost a water source. There's been a lot more expansion of the Guzzler program, so hopefully that's helped set off some of that. But
yeah. That's very true. And we didn't incorporate Guzzlers in this. Another good one to put in the model, because we actually do have species there. Springs came out as the strongest variable. And a lot of those guzzlers are put in areas where there are somewhat natural springs, but subsidizing that water is not subsurface for them in these little drainages. And so those springs are still popping up. Because unlike the water sources you're talking about, those are higher elevation water sources that are in the draws associated with springs.
So, again, a follow-up. It strikes me that the water at the surface where it's available to various wildlife is very important for wildlife that need to drink the water. It's also important for wildlife that need the vegetation, the green forbs, for example, for sage-grouse, that need that vegetation that is dependent on the water.
And I've been a little puzzled in my own brain about the level of dependence of sage grouse on water to drink, and also what sort of places create a drinkable water supply, if that is important. It, does a water trough count, or does it need to be water on the ground, et cetera? And I'm curious about this confusion in my brain between the plants versus the water, and then the microgeography, if you will, of that water availability to the grouse.
Well, those are great questions. And questions we're asking, too. This is a obviously more broad-scale mapping attempt where we can't get to the detail like that, but we are at some of our sites marking birds, and I've talked to you about this with GPS transmitters that are getting high frequency location data, so we could look at the green line on these riparian areas and see, you know, just what amount of riparian area they're using, how far into that riparian area they're going. Are they actually approaching the surface water, or are they still in an area where there's subsurface water but relying on that tree vegetation? That high frequency data is giving us information about that. You know, my anecdotal, just looking at some of these data, they're not highly dependent on surface water. They could go days without it because they get a lot of water from the plants, but they do need that surface water. If it dries up, they move on. But the forms are really important associated with it, and that is primary food source. And during the early wintering, the insects are associated.
It seems to me also that the availability of the surface water is going to be highly correlated to some other things that you've done work on. And one is the pinyon juniper, because the trees intercept about 50% of the water that falls right on them, and they have that has a large effect on the availability of water elsewhere downstream in the watershed of the places where the trees are growing. A lot of springs start flowing after the fire that burns the trees or after there's a treatment, or vice versa. They used to be there and they've dried up. And then the other one is your work on horses. And one of the things that I think is most concerning about horses is they are even more prone to go to riparian areas than cows are. And when we damage the functionality and dry up the sponge, turn it into a pipe, and then dry up the riparian area, that would presumably be a really bad thing, according to your data, about their dependence on these springs or surface water or riparian areas and the shrinking of late brood-rearing habitat. And it strikes me that at this point in time, one of the really big needs is for a published quantitative lentic monitoring protocol that gets at that question. And unfortunately, the lentic AIM protocol is pretty worthless. And we really need an adequate monitoring protocol that will measure trend in this fundamentally important thing, whether we're maintaining or restoring the sponge or not. And I think it's important for horses. I also think it's important for, of course, livestock grazing management. The good news with livestock is we got lots of tools and we can move the animals around, but with horses, they tend to be season-long continuous. And those wettest zones of our slope spring meadows are getting beat up, and we're losing the resource. And we got to figure out a way to measure that so that we can incorporate that into our AML calculations, I believe.
Yeah, I skipped over a lot of the biology, which you're talking about. Now I'm thinking I should have talked a little bit more in depth about it, because it's hitting on the points that you just hit on, as far as pinyon-juniper interaction with wet meadows. And this actually targets those wet meadows just by default, and not really even like manually going and looking for wet meadows that are associated with PJ. That's what came out in our parameter estimation. Birds are selected for these high elevation wet meadows, but the ones that have PJ associated with them, they have lower survival rates. And for the reasons you're talking about, we have a loss of water, and over time, probably going to lose that wet meadow altogether, both from interception and also from the transpiration of water into the environment, which is, you know, the depleting the water table associated with outwet meadow. But also,
in phase three, we've got 7 to 11 times more leaf area per acre than we do in phase one or zero.
Yeah. So we think of these as ecological traps, and it's probably the best area to remove these trees. We actually did a study specifically on this, looking at movement of grouse in relation to the trees and wet meadows. And it turns out that a lot of birds are avoiding those wet meadows because there's trees associated with them. But there's a lot of birds that are selecting them, too. And those that are selecting them have like 20% more survival rates than those that are avoiding them. And it kind of, that was an independent analysis from really outdated or data quite some time ago. And all the new data would be a very similar type of response here. But now we're able to map it. So we can figure out where those ecological traps are. And that might be, for example, a much higher credit to hit those areas as opposed to an area that is, that's far from wet meadows in general, but also those areas that have a higher density of sage grouse associated with wet meadows, removing trees in those areas. All of that would come out in this type of process and planning. It factors in all those variables.
Thanks, Pete.
It's wrapped in there. It's just getting together more with the science working group and figuring out the nuts and bolts on how to integrate it all. That's something
I think we have consensus group that's what we want you guys, the team and the science working group, to keep working with. Figure out how to fold all this together, and I'm sure we'll see a action item on a future agenda. Okay, here's what we're proposing, here's what it looks like, and how we can use these tools. But we're all very supportive, correct? We have consensus on that.
Only concern I'd have is how much bandwidth increase will this be in terms of.
Well, based on an upcoming agenda item, maybe we can get some revenue, and then we can get some butts in the seat.
Well, and I think we've all experienced it. You know, Pete has been there and presented this information and more information. Mm-hmm. And boy, just digesting it. I mean, it's great information. You can see how the utility in it. How do we incorporate it? You know, do we have tiers for the type of conservation actions? Or you can still generate credits, but maybe not as many. Depending on the area you're in, or the conservation activity that you're conducting, or the relevance to the different seasonal type of habitat or life stage. I mean, all of these things we're having to try to contemplate and work in. But our system is complex as it is, and this adds potentially many layers of complexity, and we need to figure out what layers we can live with without overcomplicating.
Yep.
Already, and so that I think is going to be the real challenge for us, is to get really good conservation on the ground, but not make it so difficult that it scares people away or it's too cost prohibitive to do. So I would say this, it's going to take us some time. This is not going to be, our system was developed with science, and it doesn't react, and we shouldn't react with knee-jerk reactions, turning the dial down or up. We need to really, think about the big picture, a longer term. That's just going to take time.
Yep.
I wish I could sit here and say I think we will have something to present to you in 6 months. I'm not sure if that's reasonable.
Sure.
I'm thinking it's probably going to be more like 12 months, maybe.
But it's more important to get it right than to just get something else out, get everybody looking at it, and then, oh, crap, we got to change it. So,
Yeah, and along those lines, you know, at a previous meeting, you know, what kind of spurred this on, but, you know, we've been, a small part of our EADS funding comes from us. So we've known that this science is developing is, you know, is going to be available. But, you know, the challenge is going to be incorporating.
It is very complicated. We don't want to overcomplicate it for my friends. On the other hand, you know, not every property is the same, not all the properties are equal. And being able to account for some people were learning to assign and incentivizing the protection of those properties that do have the highest values is important.
Yeah.
For sure. You're gonna hear this more and more, especially as we begin to develop and review the land use plans is growing the core. And so, you know, this kind of hits on a later agenda item, but within the strategic action plan, this is critical to how that plan is going to be developed. And, you know, the old plan had a whole bunch of maps and so on. I think this plan might be pretty thin. Because we're going to cite links.
Like, yep.
If you're a local working group, you can use this link. You can, you know, contact us and we can help walk you through it or meet with your group. But it's going to be, I think, this is going to be very helpful because instead of trying to write it out over 50 pages, we're just going to talk about the areas, the known concerns in those areas. And then link it to websites or tools that a local work group can use. This is going to be really beneficial.
Yeah, no, I will say we're making our best attempt and very successful at it so far, getting all this information published in peer-reviewed journals. So if anybody wants to go back to see what's under the hood kind of thing, it'll all be in articles. But you can't really do much with that journal article. We need to develop a user interface, and that's our next step now.
Right.
We're in the process of that. Those will be published interfaces as well. All the methodology will be in environmental software journal so that folks can go look at that. We'll have user guides and things like that for the interfaces.
One of the key questions, I think, for using the sophistication of those maps that are fairly detailed is the question of how static are those maps. And you know, when we do a credit project, we're expecting people to maintain it for 30 years. And the maps may be pretty dynamic so that over a 30-year time period, things would naturally be changing quite a bit. And I think that question is something we need to be thoughtful about. And it links to another question that we've addressed before, and that is the connection to the ecological sites and the state and transition models for those ecological sites or disturbance response groups, and linking up your information to those site maps and to those models, I think would be an excellent way to add power to the tool, because the sites probably don't change in terms of the what site we're in. But the condition of the sites can change dramatically depending upon whether they're in a relatively stable state or about to transition across an ecological threshold. And that state and transition with various phases can be very instructive for knowing what we can do about it and what we can't do about it in various places. Have you been working very much with Tamsin or Patty in that work to add that power in?
I have. You know, to some degree, this has a lot of that incorporated into it. I skipped through all those slides. I don't know if you saw the resilience resistance slide, but that was going to be my explanation, how the growth rates for all different vegetation types vary through time based on those underlying soil conditions. And the model actually projects out the restoration activity through time based on those different conditions. Now, we haven't gone to the DRG level yet. We're doing that for another analysis, and then eventually I think we'll bring this in the conservation planning environment. But yeah, I mean, that's in there. And you could actually make projections of 30-year, 50-year, 60, 100-year out on whether or not, if you do PGA removal, whether or not it will transition into annual grass based on the type of removal you do, mechanical versus lop and scatter. All of that are drop-down menus in there. And most of it is borrowing from the literature. A lot of it's studies we've conducted, or we're in the process of collecting those data. And some of it has to be professional opinion that parameterizes that model. There's a lot that goes in the conservation planning tool environment. The next thing we do, getting to your point on these dynamic systems, for example, water, we talked about that, is they change drastically under drought versus wet years, just how functional that riparian is for sage grouse. And you have a series of drought years, and you could have an otherwise great riparian area that's just not usable for sage grouse. And we're seeing a lot of that in a lot of areas in the southern portion of the range and in the bi-state, and these grouse will leave those areas entirely. So we want to make those maps dynamic under different precipitation conditions. We've actually included precipitation variables into the model. We just haven't predicted under what precipitation condition the actual habitat map changes. But the next step, it's something that's relatively easy to do because we've brought in the weather variables.
Mr. Chairman?
Yep.
It was very encouraging, your report on by state. That's good news.
Absolutely.
Very much so.
We like a little good news once in a while. We need good news.
By state, just those populations.
Yeah,
it seems like they're trending up a little bit.
Yes.
That's extremely encouraging.
Yes. I agree.
Thanks, Pete. Appreciate
okay,
it. Thanks
you,
a bunch.
Chairman. Thank you, Council. Please be here and see you all again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Kelly, I don't see Jordan, so we're going to skip. And we'll go on to 8. Review a proposed bill draft request to establish authority for the Sagebrush Ecosystem Program to collect an administrative fee associated with transactions within the conservation credit system. We'll consider support of the BDR. He's not here, so yes, I did.
We did print out something that's in your packet.
Yeah, if you want to review that. Yeah, America would be cool.
And we'll be working with the governor's office and the other agencies to look for opportunities to
get the money.
I would be comfortable if the council did or want to discuss that. However,
it's up to you guys. America the Beautiful.
The only comment I had is back on the deal where it says what is underserved. I'd say sage grouse are underserved. So
yeah. Whatever. I visited with Jordan a little bit last night, and he had an eye-opening experience yesterday on that tour. So I think he has a pretty good idea of where we want to put some of this money. He'll work with you guys and me. Okay, let's go on to our BDR.
Yeah, and I'll make this quick. So, 2 years ago, the director's office, on the behalf of the program, pursued a bill draft request that would allow us to have the authority to select fees associated with mitigation. It made it to one hearing. Did not get through that hearing and was not heard again, so therefore failed. We're going to make another attempt at that. It hasn't been approved yet, so it's just our initial request to try to get authority to administer fees associated with this CDS transactions. And I just want to make a clarification. So this BDR does not outline what the fee would be, what it would look like, how or amounts or anything like that. So this is going to
essentially in NRS, so the statute will give us authority through a regulatory process to establish a fee. The regulatory process will have to go through public hearings and meetings, and of course brought to you as well. And so it'll be just like when we went through the process, the regulatory process to require mitigation. So everyone will be aware, we'll have the public meetings, and that's how the fees, you know, if this BDR is the pass, would be developed. So just wanted to make that clear.
I got a lot of questions, but I guess all those. Who's going to pay?
Who's what?
Who's going to actually pay it?
Yeah.
I'd hate to see it shouldered on developers.
That'll be part of that.
Part of that conversation. So this will be enabling language that enables us to go through the process of doing the regulations and the fees. So if it gets moved. So
I think it's a good idea.
We have to do something.
Yeah. And I'll just add to, you know, part of the reasoning for this is, I mean, you know, is we essentially have two subcontractors. We have EI that helps us integrate some of the science into the CCS and develop some of the products that we have within the CCS. And then, of course, we have the science. And we're not where we're at today without Pete and other folks, you know, the science that enables us. That work is not inexpensive. It's labor intensive. We need several years of it to be able to establish it. And so our thought is that some of the fees that would be collected are going to help us continue to get more surgical in how we assess debits, and I think more importantly, how we offset those debits in our credit system. So. That's the hope. I think we have support for an additional staff. I think through the director's office, look at trying to get some additional staff to help us. Most of us are resource people, not so much fiscal. We're getting to the point where there's a lot of dollars being exchanged.
Mm-hmm.
And we need some fiscal assistance to make sure that that's being managed properly, and that these financial assurance accounts are set up properly, and so on. And maybe even, you know, help us in trying to find out, are there other avenues for credit producers to maybe not be so heavily penalized through taxes and other things. So, you know, we need some help in that area. Like I said, we're resource people, not
fiscal.
Right. So. Yes, ma'am. Starla Lacey, for the record, I also just want to add, you know, having worked with the SET team, you know, from a credit purchasing perspective and looking at analysis, tremendous amount of work comes out of that team that, you know, it is a shame that there's not already a system in place to help you recoup some of that effort. But I know, you know, that the team works a lot of long hours. I just want to say how much that's so appreciated. I think it's appreciated by certainly all of us to recognize that. A lot of work has really come out of your office. It's really solid and a lot to be proud of.
And just for what it's worth, none of the other state offices do anything without attaching a fee. When I want to drill a well for somebody, I got to send in a notice of intent card. Forever, that's been, they look at it, sign it, send it back. Now there's a $25 fee that goes has to go just so somebody can look at it and stamp it. So, I mean, the arguments are simple. This should be in a way.
Same shop.
Okay.
A related thought is, you know, since our requirement applies to public lands, and, of course, the Fish and Wildlife Service has great engagement in this because of the implications to sage grouse. Would it be useful to have the SETT also be composed of a representative from each of the federal agencies, as well as the various four state agencies, so that you'd have the staffing you need to do all the workload you have?
As long as they brought their money.
Yes, the feds would have to bring their money.
Andy?
I'll find that money for you. I'll just leave that right there.
It's an idea.
It's a great idea. And I'm sure Alan and Mark will bring their checkbooks and hire somebody. Right? All right, would someone move that this body support the BDR?
So moved.
Second by Willie. Moved by Sherm, second by Willie. Any more discussion? Sagebrush Ecosystem Council will support the bill draft request to establish authority for fees associated with transactions in the CCS. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Any opposed? All right. Let's go on to the semiannual report to the governor's office. Dan, you doing this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Do a bio break real quick while he's setting this up. Keep moving. I'm getting close. I don't want my vice chair to leave in case I tip over still.
Is that what did that? You know, in the olden days when they had this Dodge car, you'd walk like
that. Oh, yeah. My uncle had one.
I wish they could still buy one.
You go ahead.
Yeah.
We're taking 5 minutes right
now. No, just, you can go ahead. Thanks.
Cool. As always, we try to show some photos to show the beautiful places we're protected as opposed to. Cops Stick Athlete has taken some beautiful photos that were included in the report. We visited a lot of ranches this spring, and one thing that I observed was a lot of people were bragging about their numbers of cowboys, more than I think I experienced 5 years ago. You know, kind of how they're constantly draining their cowboys, and you know, especially with sensitivity to riparian conditions. And anyway, so we've got this. Kathleen took this shot out at RDD, which was, really represented our experience this spring in visiting these ranches. But anyway, as always, props to everybody that makes this thing come together. And, we have the background slide in here. We have, I think, 26 mitigation transactions at the time of we wrote this report. I think Kathleen's actively working on 5. I think I'm working on 3 right now. So this is all, always depends on which day it is. As well, I think we had 75 consultants at our verifier training this spring. So as always, we're working with a number of people. To try to actively train them, to try to keep them in goods with us and where we're going and the annual changes to the program, which were minimal this year. One thing that happened is we had some really large debit projects this spring, some really large projects that were bigger than ever before. And we had great consultants that came together and said, hey, this project and this is, you know, this is how I view it, and we had some things where we turned out 175 transects to be sampled with people, and so anyway, a lot of folks working really hard to get out there this spring and bring it all together. We have some due dates we're implementing next year to deal with this better, went through a lot of kind of large scale projects. That were previously bigger than previous years. And so a lot of props to everybody that kind of came together and worked with us on that. There's a lot of work and there's always more than meets the eye. Here's a map of the credit projects. And they are blown up to some degree to make them more visible to the eye. And we've put a chart here regarding the transactions to date, as always, the available anticipated credits.
Here's a map of the Dever projects and a table of the Dever projects. And yeah, so a lot of Dever projects coming online. And let's see, other stuff. We obviously have three meetings, including the meeting today, yesterday, and the tour. We've had the science work group meetings happening. We conducted efforts relative to GIS and had our controlled environmental incentives work do a little bit of work. Justin, who's our new NDOT rep, has come on and done a great job and has started working a little bit on strategic action plan. It's been a little bit held up by how hectic the spring was with receiving dev projects. And so we've been serving as a collaborative agency. Kathleen's going to range camp right after this. So that's another thing we've participated in. A lot of plans for the upcoming year, strategic action plan, continuing these science work group meetings is some of the big ones that I'm going to point out. Another thing I want to point out, Justin's done a really good job to kind of highlight some new science in here. So he's going to, try to provide within our semi-annual report a synthesis of some of the really good science that comes out. So that's another thing I want to point out, as well as we have our general sage grouse updates on population status, et cetera.
You guys might recall, generally, this population data doesn't become available until December.
One thing I failed to point out is we have this five-year review process with credit producers, and we visited seven ranches this spring: West IL, East IL, Proper Cattle Sonomas, Proper Cattle Snowstorms, RDD, Adobe Ranch, and Hagee Ranch. And I can say, most of the time, just generally speaking, we got in the truck and said, there's really not a better person out there than this person that we toured with today and saw their ranch and saw their operation, had discussions with. And we put this in the program a few years back. And to visit these ranches every 5 years and spend some time with the landowner, and good discussion doesn't happen via email or phone call so much as face-to-face, handshakes, build relationships, and time spent. And anyway, we just sat. It's been a very busy spring and had great experiences with all our friend producers. I got in the truck and said, there's just not a better person than this person I've been riding with today, Kelly. And I had that experience on several occasions. The five-year visits are working. They're great. This is a relationship-based deal, as I kind of discussed yesterday. And anyway, that part of it was great. We got our local area working group updates in here. So that was great. People are getting back to work. Some of this within here was frustration over, we've been understaffed and haven't got to some extent, the adaptive management has kind of been the side item that we haven't got to within the last year. So there are some frustrations with that kind of reported in here. So we need to get back to that idea, and I guess improving that idea is kind of my feeling. But anyway, that's it as far as semi-annual report goes. And yeah, I think most of these pictures are Kathleen, so props to her, and props to Justin for really bringing kind of some science in here and trying to synthesize and update on that. And Kelly for helping edit everything. And yeah, appreciate all y'all as well.
Bevan.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just real quick, Dan. So if you want to amend the Lincoln one, the Lincoln County work group hasn't met since COVID, but there have been several projects, pinyon juniper removal primarily, in the area, and you might just note those.
Okay. Sounds good.
Steve.
Yeah. Is this the correct time to ask questions about the CCS? There's a lot of debits unmitigated. Still, I mean, ongoing, I guess. Why aren't they mitigated, I guess?
I think what that captures is we're deep in the process. They've analyzed it. We know the number of debits, but they just haven't conducted the transaction.
So what, I mean, I see one of these, the word out is they're about to close the mine down, and yet it's not even mitigated yet. I mean, is there a time, how long do they have?
So typically before they're issued a permit for BLM or whoever's permitting it,
And I think that's why. See, before we were involved, and before we had the agreement with the BLM, that, all right, you guys are now going to require they play in the CCS. These were already permitted. They were, Steve. Look at how old some of them are.
All right, but
and I'm not arguing that they have to be done, but that's what now they have to do it before. They have to be in the system before. Mm-hmm.
So who's going to be a little hard to deal with credits and debits and maybe not exist? I guess that's my concern.
Sure.
So,
yeah, we brought several projects to the attention of the council that had component-driven mitigation associated with them. Some of them have yet to
agree to
it, or and I will say, you know, for one example, we're working with Golbar, the original Golbar mine project, which was a proponent-driven mitigation. They proposed some mitigation. They did not involve Riga County, Indow, or the SET in the development of that mitigation plan. We were not happy with what they were proposing, essentially. And so we've asked to be brought back into the fold to have the discussion using Pete's tool to help us identify the best areas for, in this case, primarily pinyon and juniper removal. And so I think it was a week or two ago, I put out a request to have another meeting with them to try to open up that discussion to try to move things forward. There was another project that was proposed, I think that before they even began construction, I don't know if they went bankrupt or the company got sold or whatever. That was another one that was pre-2018 regulation. And they also had proponent-driven mitigation that they were expected to complete. But I will say that of all the projects post the regulation, we have 100% of one.
Hindsight's 2020.
Yeah.
Think you needed to have a bigger hammer.
It still burns a little bit. But
well, that gold bar one, we got it, you know, and there's going to be some expansions and plan of operation modifications, et cetera. And at some point, we're going to play hardball as a cooperating agency. Well, we're done. I think that's what we have to do, Steve.
One of the ones I'm looking at, the mine planning started way before. The actual disturbance happen within our time that we do exist. The start, the middle, and the finish is going to be built.
Yep.
When did they get the permit?
Before. Probably nobody to blame here, but I guess with this lesson.
You keep pointing behind me. Somebody can hit me in the head?
Yeah, no, Andow's got a comment behind him.
Yeah, I can provide a short update on Golbar. As of recent, I received emails trying to include Andow and the set in about mitigation yesterday when we got back from the field trip. So they're setting a proposed meeting in July to go over the mitigation
There has been, so I've run a number of map units within that Three Bars Restoration
yep.
area through kind of CCS as well as provided in the Peach Shop in Cali helped run the CPG tool on those map units as well. So we have a lot of data there to kind of hopefully, to come to a conclusion of what's to be kind of finished as part of that. So that's kind of been going on in the background.
Was Jake Tibbetts on those emails yesterday?
Yes, he was.
Perfect. Okay.
Is there any update on the SWEP one? Not as far as litigation.
No, to my knowledge, I don't know of other discussions. I don't believe any other discussions have taken place since our initial meeting.
It's a pretty big deal.
Yep.
Another one
that damn energy has people.
Additional complexities. You know,
I'm not going to poke on you.
The right of way that they're using was approved through an act of Congress. And so.
A lot of things have changed since environmentally.
Absolutely.
That would be grounds to be.
I would suspect that we'll have an update at the next
meeting. We'll get an update on
that. Let's talk about that on that agenda item, shall we? Okay. Someone move approval.
I'll move for approval.
One question.
Second by Sherm, discussion. Yep.
I'm sorry. Do we have to replace the director there on the first page of DCNR?
Well, yeah, he was still the director through the first half of the year, so.
Okay, I just was.
I saw the same thing, and I'm like, well, maybe we'll.
All right.
We'll let him keep his name on there instead of Captain Nuke or something like that, right? Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. SAP update. Who's doing the SAP?
I don't need to go on too much about that.
Okay.
It was 11 months ago. We met in Eureka. We brought up the thought of, you know, in 5 years, time to do an update to our strategic action plan. You know, everyone knows our staffing issues over the past year have created some limitations for us to really dive into that. Fortunately, with the addition of Justin, unfortunately, he got saddled with that the minute he walked into the
building. Awesome. Very excited.
But so he's making some inroads on that. And like I said, these new tools, this new science is going to, I think, help us really make it a much more usable document and really helpful for those that it's really intended for, which are the local area working groups, conservation districts, and others. So I'll leave it at that. But yes, we intend to have an update for you at the next meeting. That's the where we're moving, you know, where we're advancing.
Okay.
And on that one, Mr. Chairman, I just hope that we continue that focus on one, how we're getting it to the ground level. Conservation districts and multiple groups, and then whether it's through America the Beautiful or whatever else, but channeling some funding into those entities to give them
yep.
to work with.
Okay, science work group update concerning incorporation of new science and tools for possible incorporation into the CCS.
I think we've kind of had that.
We did that this morning?
Yeah, so we'll continue to provide any updates from those sessions, from those meetings, each time the council meets. And like I said, it's gonna be a bit of a slog, but we'll just continue to update.
Okay. Review and action items, future items discussed during the meeting. Same standing agenda item. So I guess when do we want to have it? And what do we want to have on there? Let's start with what do we want to have on there. Steve, what do you have?
Well, a couple things just to mention. One is, we have an update from Mark
wildlife services. Just
oh, no.
How we're dealing with predation and raven.
Okay.
Is that something to consider? And there's a reason I bring it up. This, I could kind of see what was going on out there. I asked Mark. And they had talked about with wildlife agencies how to... It was talking about dealing with some control around us. Well, there was communication breakdown. There was, by the time they got around to getting the green light to do something, there was...
Breeding season was over? Yeah.
I mean, just maybe we could bring a little attention to it. Yeah. And just a thought. And Mark, you know, he had... And the other thing, and I don't know, I'm getting out of my mind, engineering and design, like on something like transmission lines. I've watched one go through. There's another huge one coming through. I mean, are they making improvements? Is that something we can hear about? Hopefully, they don't just design another big birdhouse. And, I mean, is that... I'm interested in it. Are they
making... Welcome aboard.
I'm just throwing it out.
And that's probably very timely with all the green energy, clean energy, batteries, et cetera. We got a wheel power, how we're going to do it, so we better figure out what we're looking at.
Appreciate that.
Anybody else have anything?
Are we going to discuss GreenLink one of these days? Or?
I guess we'll be a cooperating agency.
Is Endow... Do you know how engaged they've been with that?
Maybe Green Link, North, and West. Green Link.
So, yeah, we've been engaged in both. So the Green Link North doesn't go through greater safety grounds. We analyzed it. There's no impacts.
West doesn't go through. North does.
Oh, North, yeah. I'm sorry. West does not go through.
Just a little bit.
But it does go through some bisate, and we talked about this a little bit. We're trying to see if there's a way that we can use the CCS or quasi kind of CCS tool to analyze the impacts to the bisate sage-grouse. I'm a little cautious there because they have an executive oversight committee. They have plans to do conservation work already. And so I don't know how involved we would be on the credit side to offset the impacts, but we're certainly willing to work with them on that. So, but the GreenLink North, it's a significant span, I'll say, and we've been working closely with them on that, analyzing the route, siting, how we might be able to reduce impacts as well. And there's another power line that's coming in from Utah into Ely, going through some significant, in some cases, undisturbed habitat that's going to be pretty impactful. And that's where I've been as vocal as I can about the need for this avoid and minimize prior to mitigation. This kind of hit landed in our laps. The siting was already not predetermined, but you know, and in our opinion, you know, for the impacts to greater safe grounds, we asked them to consider some alternative sites to lessen the impacts, which. Takes me to another point in that one of the things that I've noticed with our staff, and you know, we work very closely with Endow because they're also cooperating agencies, and it's really the burden's on kind of on us to analyze it for impacts to wildlife, and so we work closely with them, but you all know. These EISs, there it takes time to go through them. They are thick. They are intensive. I think, you know, one of the positions that I've requested to get some assistance is simply have a person on staff that could act as our essentially NEPA specialist to help us respond and be engaged up front to go through the avoid and minimize process before the planning begins. I know that there were some discussions with Greenlink North, you know, trying to move it into the I-80 corridor to kind of lessen the impacts of some challenges in doing that. It's currently co-located with an existing power line for the most part. But one of the things, you know, we don't have a crystal ball. We can assume that there's probably going to be some ancillary impacts that occur simply by its existence and availability of new power. But like I say, those impacts will have to be analyzed as they are developed. And then all we can analyze is what's being proposed. And so, yeah, we're working closely with Energy trying to do everything that we can, especially in critical areas, to install the purge deterrents and analyze the effectiveness of the purge deterrents and so on. I talked with Nevada Rural Electric Association. I was hoping to get down to their annual meeting. That's a real need, is to begin to try to understand what deterrents are deterring, how effective they are, sharing that information as well. So, as we all know, this green energy is going to create some new challenges for everyone.
So I think in order to stay germane to the agenda item, I don't want to get into discussion on Greenlink because we're not agendized to talk about Greenlink. Maybe let's put that big overarching umbrella on the next agenda, how they're building it, where they're building it, and an update.
To the extent that that's brought up as something we'd like to discuss.
Yep, that's something we would like to discuss.
Oh, okay.
Same
with Swift.
Yep. I didn't want to get started in the hot seat when we start. No, you're going to mitigate now.
Well, I did want to.
Go ahead. You can speak.
Just say a little something. Give a little shout out here to the process, both from BLM perspective as well as working with the set. So, officially, Greenlink's not even in the NEPA process yet.
Right.
So we've had our first public workshop where we sought input, and that's where people said, hey, would you look at I-80, look at some different alternatives? And we're very early in that process looking at alternatives. But I cannot stress enough how great that collaboration with the set has been, because it's been very informative. You know, speaking as a project proponent, to be able to analyze and look at, hey, you know, maybe if you move the line this way, you know, you're going to avoid some habitat. It's been really outstanding, which, again, I just can't underscore the value. Being able from a BLM perspective to have these public workshops and input early in the process where you can try to, you know, really maximize your rooting is so helpful. And I hope, I fervently hope that that serves as sort of a model for future transmission lines. The earlier in the process, it's so much easier to make all those moves in engineering very early on, so you're minimizing from the outset. It's really been a great experience. So, again, Kelly, thank you so much. Your team, I just have so much confidence. It's really great to be able to work with that caliber of science and folks. Good deal. So,
I can speak to that a little bit more. I mean, I understand we're trying to get out of here, but, yeah, this is, you know, this, she's been, Starla, representing MB Energy, earlier than anyone with regard to reaching out to us. We've had meetings, and it does seem like we're truly conducting a void, minimize, and mitigate process. It's kind of been the ideal of both conditions, I believe. And part of that's probably because of Starly's service.
we'll be trying to reconstruct it in the future. So
I don't have it.
Okay.
All things transmission and Raven related. Anybody have anything else? That's going to be a pretty good agenda. Oh, I got the flu coming on, Chris. Yeah, I got the flu coming on, man. I'm not feeling good.
At least you're consistent.
He initiates flu every year after the tour. Those pecan flus.
All right, when do we want to have it? When? I'm throwing out ideas. My meeting schedule is about jam-packed till Christmas. Oh, Pete, I swear.
That's why I just say that.
What do you got?
So, all things went off the rails. Next meeting, if you're interested, I'm working directly with Mark. We've had several meetings with Endell as well, Pat Jackson, in prepping for where to go, just to answer your question. They did get a bunch of Lex treated out there. We used a tool that we developed called Smart. I could actually show you how this tool works. It does exactly what you're talking about to designing projects and so forth, using all our Raven models and so forth. We have a special issue coming out, Human Wildlife Interactions. It has 22 manuscripts on ravens and all cutting edge science from some of the best around, you know, in the West. And we have a lot of our papers in there too, but I think that special issue and all the papers coming out will really help guide the science. Anyway, that
smart tool
is going to be also released in this upcoming year. Good. Yeah, overnight today. I could give you all you guys a copy of Human Interactions. Very best of the bot. So this is out. I can get that to you guys.
Okay.
How is August 25th?
Is that the week after Eureka Lincoln Fair? No, that's PLC.
2 weeks after.
PLC and Cody.
On the 25th.
The whole week? No, 25th, 26th, 27th, it looks like somewhere in there. But yeah, that's... See, I don't have to come, Chris. I can't be here. I'm in Wyoming.
I actually have a Dream Tag meeting the same day, so...
How about... 23,
24, 30, or
31.
August, man.
August, yeah.
Health District.
31 might be.
Cody.
I'm okay.
That's fair time. We got a reason to come back to Elko. Let's do it here.
Let's not do that.
True. All right, we're going to Gardnerville and JT, whatever. Okay. 30.
Huh? Okay, on this
one. I just don't know if we can pull off a 23rd and be in Cody on the 24th. That next week's better. I know it's Labor Day weekend. They're coming up on Labor Day, but... Anybody else have conflicts on the 30th, 31st?
I'm okay.
Or 1st, for that matter.
Or what?
September 1st.
Any of them? So far, looks okay. Good. Pick one.
Okay. Let's shoot for September 1st.
I like it. I don't know why, but I do.
S-E-C.
Carson?
More than one.
Okay. Second longest agenda item of the day, figuring out what we're going to do next. Let's do our updates. We'll start down with Fish and Wildlife, I guess.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet.
Good to be here. Mark Jackson, Field Supervisor of the Reno Fish and Wildlife Office, and I have three updates. One is we've recently hired a new Assistant Field Supervisor, and she's coming to us from our Bay Delta office, and she's been working on some sensitive water issues and and we're excited to have her. She's going to be great, and probably you'll get the chance to meet her and work with her in the coming months. So we're really happy to have Ann coming, a great addition to our team. Dr. Coates gave us some positive news on Bi-State. Unfortunately, I'm here to deal with the negative news. And you probably already know this, but we our decision to not list Bi-State was remanded by the board back to us. So we've got, we're doing some assessment now to take a look at what our options are and trying to figure out what we're going to do. But essentially what that decision did is it puts us back to 2013 where we had a proposed decision. So we've got to figure out whether to carry on with that, what that process means, or go continue on with the legal process. So I don't have a decision yet to be able to pass on to you, but as soon as I do, I will do that. And also wanted to let you know, I think everyone also knows about the bipartisan infrastructure law and the projects that were funded for that sagebrush restoration. And this year in 2022, we're funding $1.3 million worth of projects in 13 different places. It's going to be a lot of work. This year, we're focusing almost entirely on private lands, but we do hope and anticipate that in the coming years, in the next 4 years, we're going to be branching out and expanding that effort to public lands as well. So it's a big effort, a lot of help from partners. This is primarily run through our partners program with the help from the ES office, but a lot of help from our private landowners to get these projects going and planned. Now comes the fun part of contracting and moving the money around. But there will be more updates on that, and we will be working and reaching out for soliciting more projects for the coming years, because this is going to be a five-year process, and we're in year one of that now. And that's all I've got. Happy to answer any questions.
I got a question, Mark. Do you want to touch briefly on what the rule to rescind the 2020 Habitat Trump definition, if you will, what impact you see that having?
Yeah, that's a good question. I saw that this morning. I'm going to need to
dig
into that
okay.
a little more, but essentially what it's saying is that when critical habitat is designated, that there could also be a consideration for habitat that's not currently occupied, could be suitable. That's not too far out of the ordinary, because that has been considered in the past, but I think that consideration was rescinded here a couple of years back, and then now it's being stated again. So I need to look at that. You know, here in Nevada, I'm thinking about how that would impact our current projects, and I'm not sure it would impact anything we're currently working okay. on, but I need to look at that a little bit more.
Fair enough. Willie?
Mark, can you report on the status of the petition to list the Pinyon Jay?
Yep. Yeah, so we received that, within the last 30 days or so. Mm-hmm. So currently working on a 90-day finding. That's being led by our Utah office. And so we're participating, but that one should be, 90-day finding should be coming out, here by probably the end of August or so, into September.
Bevan?
Sorry, I was just pointing to Kelly, so we may want to report on that at that next meeting.
Yeah, that's a big one, because that's
yep.
what I would like to know is how that's going to impact PJ treatments, because, you know, we do that as a way to help sage grouse, but then, you know, part of what's in the petition for Pinyon Jay is people treatment. It's problematic. So having spent time working in New Mexico, this was really a burning issue for environmental groups down yep. there. And whenever we would do fire treatments and things like that, we would always get a lot of questions on it. So I don't know. That's going to be a tricky one. You're going to have to work through that.
I mean, lots of two-stroke oil and gas the next 30 days. Anybody else have anything for Mark? All right. Thank you, sir. Alan, BLM.
Okay, Alan Shepard, Deputy State Director of Resources, for the record. Couple things. Since the last meeting, about a month ago, we issued and approved plan maintenance of our 2015 amendment for Six Grouse. What we did with that is we moved forward with being able to use the next version, the 2016 map that everybody else has been using, where we've always been relying on the 15 map. So we brought that into, so we're similar to our partners. That was a key step for us. We can go further than that because, of course, the 19 plan is under injunction, but so we got that going. And the second piece of that plan maintenance was the updating of the table 2-2 within the plan to bring in newer science that's come forward and cleaned it up a little bit. So that was a key step that we did recently. I believe the appeal and protest period for that is any day, I think, is done. I think the 30-day period for that. But we're using it. We're looking at it. One of the things we're going to have to do is some of the work that's being already in progress will have to be relooked at a little bit because of that move to go to the new map, because there is a little bit of changes of some things. So things will have to happen with that. But I think it was a great effort. We wanted to do this for several years, and John and Karen Martinson, the State Director of California, the two were very direct that we're going to do it, regardless of what everybody wants or feels, and they made it happen. We got it done. So,
Alan, if I could, tell me down for the record, can you send me a copy of what's being proposed or the update to the table?
Sure. Yeah.
And I can certainly send it down. For
yep. If you would, just send me a note to remind me, and I'll do it next week.
Okay.
For you. Okay. Mark covered the buy state. Thought that was one thing I was going to cover for you in case he wasn't here. Grazing stuff, just trying to stay on top of the drought actions around the state. Looking at we got a lot of operators that are, you know, reducing numbers, taking non-use, things like that. Asking for some adjustments, you know, so all the staffs are working really closely there, which has been good. Operators are reaching out and asking for meetings, so with a lot of positive interactions there. The one tough thing, you know, everything dealing with downsized folks, we are in great need of range management specialists. We've got, I think the Battle Mountain District, I think, is down to one specialist now. Should have, I think, six or something like that. But we're about 40% under what we should have, almost 50 now across the state. Just can't keep anybody here. We get the young guys and gals to come in, get them a little bit of experience, and they're leaving us. Or we can't even get them qualified. We've got a big problem with universities changing course curriculum names, and OPM's mm-hmm. Qualification list is extremely old and antiquated. And they don't compare, even though the class is probably the, you know, range 101 is still range 101, but it's now called ecology 101, and they don't, as soon as the HR specialist sees things like that, it's crossed off the list that they don't qualify. So there's a lot of stuff going on there. So we're trying to fill staff in all places. Wildlife biologists, same way. We've got a lot of bio spots that are definitely in need of filling. Let's see, we talked a little bit about transmission lines. To answer your question, Steve, on poles and things like that, the facilities themselves, I can tell you John has made a very firm commitment that, especially with Greenlink West, that in tortoise habitat, bi-state sage-grouse country, they will be taken into account, those species. The proper poles will be put in there to limit perching as much as absolutely possible and not turn them into big bird houses, like you said. So he's very, very pointed with that, and I'm sure he'll be the same way with North. knowing that it's coming across all that sage-grouse country. So I just wanted to make sure that, you know, John's commitment in that, and he's been very vocal about that. And I think the meetings that have occurred have been really good, really positive. I think with West, I think the NEPA document will probably be, I think it's September-ish is kind of the target right now, September-ish, early October. I think it's a little ahead of schedule to get out to the public for the first round, but there's so many alternatives being looked at, options of routes and things that the contractor and the proponent and BLM are talking a lot of different things and trying to develop the right alternatives to put in the document. So, but the meetings that have occurred have been really helpful. From Greg Helseth is my project manager on it, and with all the meetings, they've been very positive and very helpful. So, let's see. Renewable energy is huge, of course, like everything, everywhere. Every week we get a new application for something in some form, some place. Battle Mountain seems to be the heaviest hit. You know, Nye County and all their country, Eureka, you know, there's especially that corridor, you know, of course, with the transmission line coming, it's hot and heavy in that stuff. And the Tonopah office is really getting hit. So, everybody's favorite horses. First gather of the summer is going to start 2 weeks. That'll be the Triple B. That's much needed gather. And then we've got three other ones associated. We're going to do a connective action with California in the Buffalo Hills area that ties into Twin Peaks. Next door to it to the west. So that's going to that'll be in July also. So we're going to have two pretty big gathers going on in July, all pretty key grouse country. Blue Wing Seven Shrubs country and above Lovelock there later, and that'll be in August. And then towards the end of the fiscal year, September-ish, will be the Calico Basin up there below Sheldon, up in the northwest corner. If everything goes right, should be right around 5,000 animals between the four gathers removed. So, and we to date, we've removed just plus or minus 3,250. So that'll put us at about 8,400 for the year if everything goes right with contracting and weather and all the fun things. So,
what is the status on your holding facilities?
I was playing next.
Don't look at me. I didn't say anything. I'm working.
Actually, the new expansion of the Fallon facility at Indian Lakes, it is really close to contract. There's some final steps going on. We hope to have it under full contract in July, early July, is, I believe, the target. We've put the funding in. Now it's just up to the contracting folks to, you know, get the pulled together and the signatures put in place. So that'll take that facility to about 7,600 maximum capacity when that project's completely done. Construction's already, he's already taken the initiative to start building already outside of the contract, but that's fine. He can do that. That's his desire. So that's where that one's at. Our facility in North Winnemucca in Paradise Valley that we're proposing, the contractor is working, trying to work through the CAFO permit and get that into place. I have no idea when that's going to go through. It's kind of a sticking point right now. We can't issue a contract to that facility until we have a CAFO permit. I don't know the hang-up exactly, but it's at NDEP, and they're working and trying to. It has to still go out for public comment, I believe, and so it's not even up to. So we're talking probably months with that one. which is unfortunate. We really need that space. But I think there's some concerns that's going on that's out of my realm, and I'm not going to go there. But Mark covered the pinion jay, and then got a lot of fields projects on plans for the summer and the fall. The fire with the bill money, the goal is to double our treatments in the coming years. So each year we've got some big targets to fill. So I think there's some pretty positive advances coming. The bill money is really going to be helpful, but then we've got regular sage-grouse money that we've got. And I think we're meeting with the Forest Service and Fish and Wildlife soon. I don't know when it actually is, to try to figure out how we partner bill money and projects and go in a group effort in a lot of our stuff. So that'll be a positive step. I know John and Bill have talked quite a bit about doing some of this, and as well as I think even tying in Endow with Tony. So I think that's it. Any questions?
One question. It's been mentioned many times that that swept line is a legislative action. Is there any review left, or is it just regulated?
Yeah, there's one segment that has to be recultural because they have to go around a spot. And it's identified in all this stuff. So that piece has to have some cultural clearance done. But I think other than that, it's just to get a few wrapped up a few things. And then I know there's been some discussions on the mitigation funds that were already put into place with and how that will be used, how that's being, what amount of money is left from it, that type of thing.
So if there, say we found a new active left directly in line since the original action, nothing can change as far as route. I mean, is that where we're at?
I think so.
Wow. Okay. So that's too good.
Okay.
Anything else for Alan? Go ahead.
I got one real quick, Mr. Chairman. Bevan Lister for the record. Alan, do you know if the BLM has any intention of submitting their findings on the 2019 plan back to the court?
Headquarters is dealing with that, so I'm not sure the process, what they're actually doing. I know right now with the 29 stuff, they're looking at all the, to see how to satisfy the judge's questions, concerns.
Right, see, I thought all that was done, and they had come out with the second decision. They reaffirmed the decision, but they never resubmitted that to the court. So that's where
I don't know. I think that's a decision. I think even outside of the wildlife division, I think it's an upper management leadership of making that decision of where we're taking that step. Yeah,
fair enough. Yep. Thank you.
Anything else?
Okay. Josh, Forest Service.
Thank you. Josh Nichols, I'm the district ranger for Mountain City Roof Mountains and Jarbidge, for the record, here representing Bill Dunkelberger. Bill passed on some updates to me, so I'll share those with you quickly. And then if I could, I'd like to throw in a couple local ones as well. So we've got approximately $500,000 appropriated funds this fiscal year that will be allocated towards sage-grouse habitat improvement across the forest. And we're currently working with our Shared Stewardship Executive Committee to apply for America the Beautiful and Infrastructure Bill funding to get some additional projects going there, primarily geared right now towards invasive species reduction, but other projects as well. So, like has been mentioned many times before here in this meeting, we'll be returning the special use application for the Green Link project due to some concerns that we have related to our sage-grouse plan, but we'll be reaching out to, like everybody, to come up with some alternatives and see if we can move that forward. And let's see, the Santa Rosa District was recently funded under a Joint Chiefs proposal to do some additional work with fuel breaks and noxious weed treatments. And then right now, the forest is filling some additional fisheries and wildlife biologist positions that'll be new to our orchard. So these are brand new positions that we haven't had before to hopefully gain some capacity. So those were Bill's updates. Here locally, I just wanted to share that, you know, I'll be meeting tomorrow with some of the key partners in our shared stewardship landscape group to look at putting in some America the Beautiful as well as Joint Chiefs proposals here within the shared stewardship landscape. And a big thanks for letting us, you know, participate in your field trip and be here for this meeting this morning. So.
Questions or anything for Josh? Well, I want to thank you guys for taking the time yesterday, too, going all the way down there and showing us that last end. So it was, I think it was very well received. Thank your staff.
Thanks.
All right, Ray's not here. Jordan, we'll go to the state. Jordan's not here. Dominic, DCNR.
Thank you. Dominic Escalante, Deputy Director of the Nevada Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. We already heard about it a little bit earlier, asking about whose name should be on this report. As you know, our director has been nominated to sit on the Nuclear Regulatory Agency, and his last day in the office was just a week or so ago. He is going to continue to be a state employee, though, through August 1st. He's going to continue to represent the governor, the Western Governors Association. And he is burning a lot of his time because, as a state agency, we do not have the funding required in the budget to buy him. So he's using a lot of that and taking that time to deal with his one-year-old daughter. So that's nice for him to have that break. But he, you know, we still communicate with him regularly. And just so you're all aware, if you're not already, our internal proposal is for Jim Lawrence to be hopefully appointed our director. But in the meantime, hopefully be our acting director. So he has been delegated that authority by Brad. We're working with the governor's office to ensure that that appointment is made. Because people often think that, you know, Jim and I competing with one another, and when I throw my full weight and my support behind him. He's been with the agency for, 20 plus years, and is just a wealth of so he's the right person for the job. We are going to probably continue to split duties as we have in the past. In Brad's absence, we'll be shorthanded for a little while. I'm here today, but I think likely in the future, Jim will continue to engage with the council.
Okay.
We already got a lot of our update through staff and through Kelly. And we're short on time, so I'm not going to go through all eight divisions and programs. But a couple maybe bigger items. You know, yesterday we were out looking at some of the work that has been done. And some of that work was through the assistance of our Division of Forestry. Casey might have mentioned a little bit, but we are having a lot of challenge. They're statewide, not just staffing, but also through our conservation camps program. The number of inmates that we have of this probably close to 10%. A lot of that, you know, first we thought it was maybe COVID related. Really, now that COVID has changed, we're learning that no, it's really the early release program, the bill that was passed by the legislature. So just about the time that they become eligible to work in our camps, they're also eligible for release. So we're going to have to be looking at some changes of how we can effectively get the work done out on the landscape. In some of our camps, we have crews that are made up of crew bosses. We don't have inmates. Went out to Wells just before yesterday's meeting, the day before. We only have two employees in Wells, and we had about six inmates that we've been running. And one of those employees is taking another job in about 2 weeks. So we're going to have one employee. It makes it very difficult for us to meet our mission. We're going to be looking for additional staff so that we have internal firefighters who are full-time to help us meet the mission. But that's, of course, going to be a request that's going to require general funding and money from the state, so that'll be a difficult ask at a time like this. But we've heard a lot of you know, one of the things I want to drive home is I think that that is an incredible opportunity for the state to be very engaged and to help ensure that collectively through our federal agencies or state agencies, we are putting our limited resources, our dollars in the ground in the places that matter the most. And I want to thank Kelly and our Sagebrush technical team for being engaged with shared stewardship to help ensure that when we're looking at the risks and the opportunities from a Sagebrush, Sage-Grouse perspective, that is an important part of that discussion. So I think that's very helpful. I think it's very effective. You know, even though we've been working on this for years to this point, it's still just getting up and running. So we have we have opportunities through, you know, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act where we know there are federal dollars out there trying to ensure that they land in Nevada. Once the shared stewardship program is more developed and we've got project lists, local projects where we've completed our cold shore, we've gone through our NEPA, and we have shovel-ready projects, we're going to be in a better position to take advantage of those types of funding opportunities. I think it's going to help us land more federal dollars here in the state of Nevada to do the work that's important for this council. Real briefly, we have an off-highway vehicles program, and you know, we have $1 million or so per year that we're able to put out on the ground through grant projects. Obviously, a lot of that is for off-highway vehicle recreation, but a lot of that can also be used to mitigate impacts or realign routes and fix some of the damage that occurs out there. So, from a Sagebrush ecosystem perspective, if you've got thoughts, ideas, you've got local groups, I want to get those dollars out on the ground. That they're as effective as possible. You know, that's what's good for OHV recreation, is ensuring that we're not having those negative impacts. That's what allows us to continue to grow there. I'm sure there's a lot else I could talk about, but I know that we had a hard stop of 12.
We blew right through. So,
if you've got questions, I can answer questions. But those are some of the quick updates.
Questions for Dominic? Okay. Kelly.
I wanted to mention that just after we left on Tuesday, I got an email from Ray Johnson. I'm not sure if it went out to all of this group. I'll forward it maybe on the drive back. But
okay.
Anyway, he's accepted a new position, I believe, in Texas.
He's been wanting to go, so yeah.
I'll forward his message.
Okay. Thank you. Wildlife. Somebody give them an update? Nope. See? Now that's how you keep us back on schedule. Ms. Brown.
I'll be short and sweet. I think the shared stewardship comments that both Josh and Dominic made is where we're obviously engaged in that process. We'll be involved in your meeting, Josh, on Friday, and then a meeting that the Forest Service is putting on specifically related to annual invasives. And I think for the priority for the department is annual invasives and native seed production stuff. So those are the two realms of the world related to this group that we'll be engaging in and hopefully making some applications related to both bill funding through America the Beautiful and FDA opportunities. And we're working on the recruitment process I've had some couple of fires. We don't have an admin assistant for plant right now, and so I'm the one that has to do all the recruiting through Success Factors. And so anyway, I'm hoping that we'll get some interviews set up soon. We have a couple of applicants for the ag position on the technical team and work through that interview process and hopefully have a successful candidate. Fourth time's the charm. And I think that's probably where I'll leave it for now. So maybe we can.
Thank you.
You're welcome. If you have any other specific questions related to Department X, then I'm happy to engage.
What do you have, anything? How's the cricket phone calls going?
No.
You don't have to answer that. CDs.
I purposely left that out.
I know. Wow. Anybody? I don't think we have anybody from CDs either. So. Okay. Public comment. Any public comment?
I would like to make a brief public comment.
Yes, sir.
Is governed by NRS 490. If any of the council members would like to review that, I also encourage any of the council.
the more information that can be exchanged, I think, between this group and the next, the better. So, I'm happy to discuss offline too. So, thank you.
Have some ideas.
Not for public comment, I don't think. Any other public comment? Any public comment? Is there a motion to adjourn? We are adjourned. Thanks, everybody. I tried, Chris.
I'm out of here.
You're a couple minutes late, but Alan just left. He didn't even hang out. He didn't even wait. Another Alan.
I got lightning just blowing up all over down the road yesterday. Yeah, my detector's going off. My phone keeps alerting me. Looks like they're going to transition to wet, so I'm going to start making tracks.
I didn't
get my shovel out.
Pee on it.